Welcome. The peace revolution now continues.
Breaker, breaker, 1-9. I'm in outer space with a microphone.
Hi, I'm John Taylor Gatto, and this is What You've Been Missing.
I bring a message from your master, Marcus Licinius Crassus, commander of Italy. By command of his most merciful excellency, your lives are to be spared. Slaves you were, and slaves you remain. But the terrible penalty of crucifixion has been set aside on the single condition that you identify the body or the living person of the slave called Spartacus.
I'm Spartacus!
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 America. There's a war and we're in it. I know we can win it, so let's take back America. There was a dream, so believe it and get ready to receive it. Now let's take back America. And when the war is over and we've won it, let's remember how we done it so we don't have to.
Welcome to the Peace Revolution Podcast. I'm your host and navigator, Richard Grove, and this is where we step out of the confusion, fear, and anxiety of everyday life to relax into some knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. You're listening to Podomatic's number one rated podcast in higher education. Thank you for making time in your busy schedule to tune in and grow in the light direction. If you're a new listener, this podcast acts as a virtual classroom for adults designed to point out and provide useful perspectives, resources, and information. Each episode contains a subject of study essential to a comprehensive understanding of reality, all of which is focused on providing you with the history, context, references, and the various methods and tools so that you can learn for yourself that which public schools cannot afford to provide. Peace Revolution and all the educational media we create here at TragedyandHope.com is presented as a public service. That means it's without corporate sponsorship and is published commercial free and presented free to the public. Thanks to the generosity of the subscribers, to the Tragedy and Hope online community, and the hard work of the media hosts featured at TragedyandHope.com. As always, I encourage you to check the episode notes, references, and links for this and all episodes we publish, located at peacerevolution.org. I also invite you to click on the invitation link inside the episode notes and participate in the Tragedy and Hope online community and learn how to apply this journey of discovery to your everyday life. If after studying the episode notes you're looking to learn more, Peace Revolution also has several partner podcasts, which likewise feature commercial-free educational episodes free to the public, including CorbettReport.com, GnosticMedia.com, MediaMonarchy.com, RemedyRadio.com, and many others, each of which uniquely fills the void left by public schooling and mainstream media. This is a very special interview episode of Peace Revolution featuring the gentle tone, scholarly insights, and wealth of wisdom that combines in the form of John Taylor Gatto, the legendary educator, author, and icon of liberty, who offers a lifetime of perspectives on the origins, intentions, and destiny of the compulsory public school system. Now, since the process of post-production on this DVD project has taken a bit longer than I expected, I thought it would be a good idea to offer these next four episodes of Peace Revolution as we finalize the DVD set and the website. To employ the use of simile, the process of completing this project has been a lot like trying to sip a tidal wave. The audio for this episode is taken from the first hour of the Ultimate History Lesson, A Weekend with John Taylor Gatto, filmed on July 4th weekend, 2011, in the Constitution State of Connecticut. This is a comprehensive interview session which memorializes John's life's work and embodies what we know as our birthright as human beings. Truly an event which is relevant and relative to each and every one of us. The message contained in these episodes applies to children and adults, parents and grandparents, students and teachers, as well as administrators and politicians. Blue collar, white collar, no collar, everyone who uses words and symbols to meet their needs, and everyone who depends on money to survive. This episode will offer the first hour of the interview with John, 15 minutes at a time, at which point we'll comment and provide you with the references for about 15 or 20 minutes, and then we'll repeat this process through this episode, as well as the next four episodes of Peace Revolution. Today I'll be joined by Jan Irvin of GnosticMedia.com, Paul Verge of DivergentFilms.com, and Tony Myers, Kevin Cole, and Lisa Arbuchesky of TragedyAndHope.com. And together we'll have a roundtable discussion at an adult level as to the meaning and substance of John's words. The conversation, which forms the entirety of the interview with John, is almost entirely composed of facts and references pointing toward a preponderance of evidence, which is, for the most part, unknown to the general public. And we thought that this exercise in expanding on John's thoughts would help to provide you with the necessary context through which you might best be able to receive his intended message. We're not asking you to agree with us, nor to believe what we're saying. We're simply trying to provoke you into looking into these matters for yourself by providing you with an accurate map which leads to your own factual and substantial understanding of reality. For as Aristotle once wrote, "It is the mark of an educated mind to be able to entertain a thought without accepting it." Through these interview sessions with John, you're going to be introduced to a variety of historical personalities, and we hope curious to review the history which has led us to this point. And to that end, this is not about disproving or debunking what we've been taught so much as it is a journey of discovery to learn to discern reality, to discover our birthright, so that we might go forward in order to meet the challenges that we all face here on this planet together. This is truly something that the corporate establishment media, public schools, and universities cannot afford to teach us. So before we begin, let me provide a 5-minute summary of why I'm here and why I thought it was so important to produce this interview series, as this isn't a justification for my investing 4 months of my life into producing this interview. Rather, it's how you might realize the comprehensive connectedness of the consequences causing catastrophic crisis on so many continents. Today's economy is the stronghold of con men and Ponzi schemers, and this has everything to do with public education producing incoherent students who then grow up to be investors. In 2002, to battle this corruption, the Sarbanes-Oxley Act was enacted by Congress to prevent corporations from deleting financial documents so as to create an audit trail of transactions for the purposes of fiscal transparency. This was done in an attempt to curb the exponentially growing frauds of the time, such as Enron, Tyco International, WorldCom, and many others. As you now know, the ongoing financial depression, which was triggered by the 2007 to 2009 global recession, was not prevented by the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. And in fact, as you're about to learn, the Sarbanes-Oxley Act enabled the triggering of the global financial depression. The American public was no longer able to recognize fact from fiction, and the incoherence instilled over generations of public schooling left the average citizen and even many wealthy or well-to-do folks intellectually unable to protect themselves from financial predation. This is the root cause of the real estate market crisis as well as the ongoing financial depression. And this is where I come into the picture, as in 2003, I became a corporate whistleblower under the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. I provided information to the SEC, and even though the law provides quote-unquote protection for whistleblowers like me, I was terminated in retaliation, and my career was ended. I filed a lawsuit. I represented myself in court against a multi-billion dollar international corporation, and after 3 years, and after proving my case in court, including the fact that the SEC acted with complicity to protect the perpetrators, my case was dismissed on a technicality, recognizing that the events I proved in court actually happened, but were conveniently, quote-unquote, outside the statute of limitations for the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. I then took my evidence and approached CBS's 2020, PBS's Frontline, and many other so-called investigative news shows, and none of them were interested in warning you, the public, about the impending consequence to the massive frauds identified by me and several other whistleblowers way back in 2003. Among the accounts I managed in New York City were J.P. Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, Citibank, Lehman Brothers, Deutsche Bank, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, Tyco International, WorldCom, Merrill Lynch, Morgan Stanley, AIG, and many, many other notorious financial services companies. Of course, back then I thought I was selling them software which was mandated by Congress under the Sarbanes-Oxley Act to prevent them from proliferating white-collar fraud, and ironically enough, the software which I was selling them, which was mandated by the Congress to maintain the fiduciary compliance, actually had a backdoor in it which allowed corporate fraud to exponentially increase, including the quadrillions of dollars in derivatives trading. After I warned the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC then purchased the product after I had also provided evidence that it had a backdoor which enabled users to circumvent the Sarbanes-Oxley legislation. And in fact, the SEC as of 2003 was actually facilitating these firms with the ability to commit crimes on a heretofore unimagined level of destruction. Our 2010 film, 2020 Hindsight, Censorship on the Front Line, features an interview wherein I explain all this in detail. This video is linked in the episode notes on peacerevolution.org and is free to all who are interested enough to inform themselves of that which corporate mass media cannot afford to share with you on this topic. Moreover, if you'd like some juicy audio to bolster your education of all things financial fraud related, Peace Revolution Episode 5, Overstocked, How Naked Short Selling and Counterfeiting Stocks Create Cascading Economic Failures, is our interview with Dr. Patrick Byrne, who's the CEO of Overstock.com, and it contains the information you need in order to start understanding the ever-growing financial depression which is adversely affecting all of us in a variety of ways. Without the public receiving the tools to discern fact from fiction and the methods to attain certainty, to plan effectively for the future, and to protect ourselves and each other from predators, the public will continue to be held slave to the fictions of con men and the legislation of legal plunderers. That's why I'm here. That's why we created TragedyandHope.com, Peace Revolution, and why I thought that one of the best things that I could do with my time over the past 4 months was to produce the following interview with John and deliver to you a long-lost gift of essential wisdom, which he refers to as your birthright. Now, without further ado, it is my pleasure to share the origins and background of our featured guest. On December 15th, 1935, John Taylor Gatto was born in western Pennsylvania, in the coal mining and steel milling town of Monongahela, about 35 miles southeast of Pittsburgh. During his early school years, he spent a year at an elite Jesuit boarding school near Latrobe, Pennsylvania, where he learned to think dialectically and was subsequently beaten by the nuns sufficiently to create his outspoken temperament, which has endured lifelong. John did undergraduate work at Cornell, the University of Pittsburgh, and Columbia University, and then he served in the U.S. Army Medical Corps at Fort Knox, Kentucky, and Fort Sam Houston, Texas. Following his Army service, John did graduate work at the City University of New York, Hunter College, Yeshiva University, and the University of California, Cornell, and Reed College, which is a private independent liberal arts college located in southeast Portland, Oregon. Like many famous American iconoclasts, John honed his skills in a variety of professions before finding his talent and passion for teaching, which proves to be his real gift to this world. After almost 30 years of teaching in New York City's inner city schools, he was named New York City Teacher of the Year in 1989, 1990, and 1991, and that same year was also the New York State Teacher of the Year. Later in 1991, he wrote a letter announcing his retirement from teaching titled, "I Quit, I Think," to the op-ed pages of the Wall Street Journal, stating that he no longer wished to hurt kids in order to make a living. Soon thereafter, he was the subject of a show at Carnegie Hall titled An Evening with John Taylor Gatto, which subsequently launched a career of public speaking in the area of public school reform. He then began a worldwide public speaking and writing career and has received several awards from libertarian organizations, including the Alexis de Tocqueville Award for Excellence in Advancement of Educational Freedom in 1997. John has been invited all over the world to share his research and has spoken to audiences in Australia, Spain, France, England, Mexico, China, and Canada, as well as every one of the 50 American states. Since his public resignation in 1991, he has traveled over 3 million air miles. He's spoken at Harvard, NASA Space Center, the White House, Smith College, and the Cato Institute, among many other places. John has also keynoted over 30 state homeschool conventions and supports unschooling and open source education for personal learning. In his book, Weapons of Mass Instruction, here's how John defines open source education. Open source learning accepts that everything under the sun might be a possible starting point on the road to self-mastery and a good life. In open source, learning sequences are personally designed or personally signed off on, and everyone you encounter is a potential teacher. In open source, teaching is a function, not a profession. Everyone learns, and everyone can learn to teach themselves as well as others. In open source, students are the active initiators. You learn that you either write your own script, or by default, without your input, you become an unwitting actor in someone else's script. The main thesis of John's body of work can best be illustrated, in my opinion, by asking the question, what do public schools actually teach children? And answering it with the main themes contained in John's first book, Dumbing Us Down, wherein, after decades of experience teaching in public schools, he draws the following observations about how these schools are designed in form and function. He relates that public schooling teaches confusion by breaking coherence. It presents an ensemble of information that the child needs to memorize in order to stay in school. Public schooling teaches them to accept their class affiliation. Public schooling makes them indifferent and suppresses natural curiosity. Public schooling makes them emotionally dependent on approval from authority. Public schooling makes them intellectually dependent on experts and authorities to think on their behalf. That seems to be the opposite of education. Public schooling teaches them a kind of self-confidence that requires constant confirmation by experts and authorities. This is also known as provisional self-esteem. Public schooling makes it clear to them that they are always supervised, under surveillance, and cannot hide, especially in today's society where everything online is tracked and private information is sold in a variety of ways to a variety of predators. And here's the bibliography. John's poetic prose and diligent documentation can be studied in his prodigious preponderance of publications, including Dumbing Us Down, The Hidden Curriculum of Compulsory Schooling, 1992, The Exhausted School, 1993, A Different Kind of Teacher, Solving the Crisis of American Schooling, 2000, The Underground History of American Education, 2001. And in my opinion, this is an essential book to read as it stimulates your internal dialogue, which draws questions as to why are children being methodically undermined, and provides the answers with comprehensive references. In 2003, Harper's Magazine published John's article, Against School. And last but not least, Weapons of Mass Instruction, A Schoolteacher's Journey Through the Dark World of Compulsory Schooling, 2008. John's website is johntaylorgatto.com, and therein you can help him fund his current projects, sample the Underground History of American Education, and browse his bookstore. We've also created a special website to support your further study of this project in particular, and it's called ultimatehistorylesson.com. This is there to act as a single point of access to all the media, references, notes, source materials, and bonus features associated with this interview set. Realizing that releasing this information is not enough, we've invested a great deal of effort into organizing and providing you with the research library and all the tools, methods, and resources that you'll need to learn your way forward following this interview. This site will also host the footnotes, links, references, and PDF versions of the classic texts which are discussed in the interview, and in the near future we'll be adding subtitles, translations into multiple languages, and much more. UltimateHistoryLesson.com will also link you to our educational media producing partners, as well as the Tragedy and Hope online community, wherein you can leverage the research for yourself, learn the methods, and use the tools all inside of an international online community which acts as a fear-free zone of mutual respect wherein individual explorations are shared to empower everybody with comprehensive understanding. The Tragedy and Hope community is free to those who need it and sponsored by those who can afford to support our educational projects. And since this entire project was funded by more than 50 individuals within the Tragedy and Hope online community, I would especially like to thank those of you who helped to give us the ability to invite John and the resources to produce the Ultimate History Lesson so that this empowering information can be understood worldwide. Additionally, we've created more than 20 productions of educational media, films, videos, interviews, and podcasts to specifically support your further understanding of this interview project, providing you with the metaphorical handles so that you can grasp the material and use it to your own advantage. And unlike any other interview you have ever witnessed, the conclusion of the Ultimate History Lesson is actually the starting point for your own personal journey of discovery. I'll also mention that due to the fact that we're trying to do something which hasn't yet been done, I've edited each hour of the interview such that from the crack of the slate until the end of the tape, you're witnessing John in a natural and forthright representation of his presence, and nothing he states in the coming hours has been taken out of order or otherwise adjusted for theatrical purposes, as I feel it would not be in anyone's best interest to change the flow of energy as it happened. Last but not least, here are two definitions which you'll find useful in the first hour of this interview. The first being the trivium method of critical thinking and creative problem solving. This is a three-step method for attaining high degrees of certainty. That's how you make decisions. Specifically, it teaches how to identify knowledge, how to organize that knowledge into an understanding, and how to communicate that understanding, which becomes wisdom. The second definition would be that of the Prussian education system. The Prussian education system was a system of mandatory education dating back to the early 19th century. parts of the Prussian education system have served as models for education systems in a number of other countries, including Japan and the United States. And with that being said, these interview sessions are designed to resurrect your curiosity, to stimulate your use of reason, to inspire you to look around, to provoke you into asking questions, all of which sparks your creativity and your inventiveness, and ignites the solution-making process in each and every one of our lives. Its function is to provide a ramp to learning, discussion, respectful debate, and compassionate forms of communication. This is episode 41, The Ultimate History Lesson, Hour 1 plus Commentary. Thank you for your support, and thank you for tuning in and not dropping out.
You know, for pushing that button, you get a camera credit. That's pretty good. Awesome. I don't even know that we'll need the slides necessarily. I mean, we can start by talking about that.
Father, Son, Holy Ghost.
Grammar, logic, and rhetoric. So grammar is the Son, logic is the Father, the Holy Ghost is rhetoric, and God is the consciousness. And so the Christian trivium came from the Greek trivium, but they used a metaphor to encode it. Now my question to you is a metaphor a lie, or is a metaphor something else?
I think we better start a little less abstract. One of the things, a fatigued old brain. I arrive at abstraction by arguing with myself through writing. So everything I write goes through about 20 drafts. And since I handwrite it, it's quite painful to read. And throw it out. But I don't really know what I say, what I'm going to say, or what I believe until I actually argue with what I think I believe. So,
what do you think you believe about schooling?
I think I believe that the metaphor schooling clearly tells you what it's expected to deliver. We only use the expression one other way commonly, and that's for the school of fish. And they are wonderful to watch. When one fin moves, all of them move. Thousands of fins move. And they're instantly receptive to what the group wishes. I don't know who gives the original signal, but education's diametrically opposite to that. I think it starts with the assumption that we get from a fingerprint or from DNA that no two people are alike, and that the ultimate realization of yourself is to find that uniqueness where your apparent physical resemblance to everybody else sort of dissolves as an illusion, and you stand absolutely alone, or you can select when you want to be part of a larger group. It seems clear to me that the business of schooling has done what Orwell clearly saw you do, or what Walter Lippmann said you do back in the 1920s. You steal the key language of the person the group you want to overthrow, and you redefine it, and people then become confused. It's Newspeak in 1984. So the schooling transformation occurs when they see that the language of education is highly regarded, highly respected, and even in people who don't participate, there's an urge in that direction. So you simply take the concepts and you claim that that's why people are being ritualized.
So you describe that individual beings, when in groups, kind of subvert their own individual thinking power. And the law of identity, none of us can change who we are. We have to be ourselves, and that is constant throughout life. So it's about figuring out how to remain individually self-reliant and self-sufficient as going through these systems that are trying to change us and to make us less self-reliant and more.
Very much so. And I think the awareness of these contrary dynamics is what gives rise to the theories of dialectic. I mean, Aristotle all the way through history, the variety of them, but they participate in the same way, is essentially asking you for your own self-defense, not to assume that what anyone says, especially as they climb the authority ladder, is the truth. Often the misinformation comes from innocent self-delusion, but just as often as you move up the power pyramid, it comes from a malign intent toward your own individuality.
So it's like a betrayal of truth that occurs, or, you know, a betrayal of you know, belief in some authority structure that you want to believe in is true, and then little by little you realize that it's not necessarily how it might have been presented to you?
Right. Even in your own individual inner life and consciousness, before the cameras rolled, I said, the way I learn what I'm thinking is to write something down that I think I believe, and then I argue with it, and it never survives. How about that? Now, what scares me is that when I go back to it year after year, most of it doesn't survive. I mean, it takes years before I get to a core and I say, I'm not personally capable of moving beyond this thing, so that we're so well conditioned from infancy not to see the truth or relate the truth, but to shave it, that the first step in reaching for an education, I think, is to mistrust what you most are certain of, to mistrust that. Now, it may survive, but it needs tested not once, until you're exhausted from testing it.
Is the school system designed to get kids to grow into a thriving, self-responsible, self-reliant adult? Or is it to whittle away curiosity and to kind of stop them from thinking for themselves?
It's certainly not the former in any way, for the simple reason that throughout history, management doesn't know how to manage independent units, even partially independent units. Why shouldn't we ask, and any school people watching your film should begin immediately to ask politely, why are we doing it? It's a question you never hear, because it's heresy. I mean, the beleaguered classroom teacher doesn't know why he or she's doing that. They're told to do it. Maybe they can give it 5% personal spin. That's why they're doing it. Does it make sense for this particular life that's asking you the question? You don't know, and if you started to care, the logic of schooling would dissolve. No one is able. You can answer the question for yourself. I used to say to my classes, and over the course of 30 years teaching, I taught kids from the Gold Coast to the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and I taught kids from the center of Harlem and Spanish Harlem. And I would say to all of them, you have a right at any time, you gotta be polite though, because I'm just human, to say, why are we doing this? And if I can't produce an answer that convinces you that I believe it, then you have a right to opt out and do something else as long as you don't run wild and bring the whole house down. It helped me grow year after year. Not that they ask very often because they're conditioned not to do that, but enough did ask that I was put on my own mettle to say, why am I doing this? And it was a continual expansion of my own insight until politically I couldn't do it any longer. The school, oddly enough, made me so internally famous that it drew extra attention, and my system couldn't survive under the scrutiny because they would see the disparity between what I was doing and what the protocols were. So there.
So it sounds like if I'm trying to get to the root cause of why your teaching career ended, it sounds like you started asking questions, John, and it sounded like the question started with why, with a question mark, and then maybe you were asking some other, like, you know, the five W's plus how, and you were actually getting observed knowledge.
Asking myself questions, right. Then forcing my classes to ask me questions and themselves questions, and eventually the productive output of my classes was so great, inadvertently, I didn't care how the school measured product, but it was so great that I would get visiting delegations, sometimes on a daily basis, for months, and they would leave baffled because they wouldn't see the drama unfolding that they understood as schooling, and they were right. It was less and less schooling, and eventually the pressure became impossible since I set out at the beginning of the year with an inner intention, if I had 120 kids, to have 120 individually written curricula. I never succeeded totally, but I got close enough that when the principal would drop by and only find 9 people in class and say, where are the rest, that I ran out of strategies to explain where the rest were. So, I couldn't operate. I couldn't function any longer because my physical strength wasn't up to it. So
how did part of the strength of your actual teaching come from releasing children from the classroom and letting them go out in the world and actually gain some useful
huge
experience?
Huge amounts of it came from releasing anyone who had an independent course to follow, becoming that boy or girl's assistant, always with the mother's permission because they couldn't deal with that kind of additional political pressure. So what they would learn and bring back would be like food for me. I would be like I was 120 people simultaneously. Oh, I learned much more than I learned at the 2 Ivy League colleges I attended. I used to say to my wife, and it sounds fanciful, as though, oh, he must love children, and which is not true. I love people, and people can be 5 years old, but people who suck their thumb and rattle and extend childhood, school's intention is to artificially extend childhood. And there really is no practical terminus for that. If they can extend it through graduate school and postgraduate.
What is the actual reason that their childhoods are being extended? How's it serve for the
society? I think what we never discuss, or that the extreme left has preempted to discuss, so they marginalize themselves, is the intimate interrelationship between the economy and the way we train the young. To the extent that we once had a wildly variegated economy. I'm quoting Abraham Lincoln in 1859, famous speech of the Wisconsin Agricultural Association. Lincoln said, I call this mudsill theory because he used that term. Lincoln said the British are financing the whole Western movement and they're attempting to reinstall their class system. And so they send their young sons over to make sure that not a whole lot of attention is paid to ordinary people or people who live in simple homes that have mudsills. He said they're not, or according to the British thinking, they're not worth training or worrying about because there's no way they can possibly improve. Lincoln said, look around you. 3/4 of our population has an independent livelihood, and the quarter who doesn't works to put a little stake together to set up on their own and write their own script in life.
Welcome back to Peace Revolution. This is episode 41, and that was the first 15 minutes of the Ultimate History Lesson, A Weekend with John Taylor Gatto. I'm joined by Paul Verge, Tony Myers, Kevin Cole, Jan Irvin, and last but not least, Lisa Arbuchesky. So I'd like to get their perspectives, and maybe we can have an intelligent discussion about all the knowledge that was just dropped in those first 15 minutes. What do you think, Paul?
Well, I think there's an overarching theme to what God was talking about, and that's the idea of how to breed obedient employees and consumers so that the purpose of the education system in terms of dumbing us down has a reason, and it's an ends because there's a system set up to essentially put people through a grinder, have them come out the other side and be malleable enough to sell products to or to direct their labor and energy to do stuff. And I thought it was interesting that he talked about the school of fish in terms of, you know, one's following the next, but who's really leading the pack. And so when he started talking about internal dialectic, the idea of speaking to yourself, of asking yourself questions, of not taking all your own thoughts to be just automatically true and correct, that without it, we are taking orders from, we're taking it from an external, without that internal dialectic, that dialogue, where we are schools of fish just following each other. And then when he got into extending childhood, I think what that does is, you know, creates this artificial stasis of learning responsibility, of staying in the kind of spoiled child kind of mentality, and spoiled children tend to emotionally react. And if we're given credit to go get all the toys that we want, then we, without having critical thinking, will tend to become kind of debt slaves and get ourselves in over our head because we didn't have the ability to deal with or make logical choices. So all in all, creating a whole army of intellectually disarmed people essentially makes them completely malleable to becoming debt slaves. And, that's sort of my opening thoughts.
Right on. Those are some very bright thoughts coming out of Vancouver, Canada. Let's go to Virginia in the United States with Kevin Cole. What do you think, Kev?
I think Paul makes some really good points. How he describes the creation of uniformity that is meant to break the will, it almost becomes a self-sustaining loop that we maintain socially without even knowing it. And he also describes how education is really a process of adjustment, and that's how they put this down in their own writings. If you can pick up a book called Social Science for Teachers, in the first line they say education is a process of adjustment. So the way to get out of that, and how he kind of describes poetically, is the continual researching to find core truths and a way to bring it back out of that adjustment function. So really this reoccurring theme in the first 15 minutes is, you know, ask questions and start caring. Because everyone has an equal opportunity on intellectual grounds. And by reevaluating this curriculum, we can, you know, essentially free our own minds from the extended childhood and the planned obsolescence of human beings. And of course, he started to get into mudsill theory and the how the farming and independent livelihoods negate the concept of the proletariat that is trying to be instituted by the British feudal system.
Well, that's quite a mouthful. I mean, for 15 minutes of an interview, it sounds like we're all getting a lot out of this. Let's go to Pennsylvania with Tony Myers and see what's going on there. What are your thoughts, Tony?
Well, both Kevin and Paul brought up some really good points, and I thought one of the big points to really reiterate here is the idea of the inner dialectic. You know, kind of talking with yourself, having that your own thought in your head, and kind of going through the process of making sure it relates back to reality and asking yourself questions, and that's really where our freedom lies. And you know, it's interesting that he pointed out that he always argues with himself and nothing seems to ever survive. And I just think that's such a powerful statement, because what it shows is that he maintains a certain level of openness to any certain situation or whatever, or context, or whatever he's trying to learn, you know, whatever it might be. So,
well, why doesn't it survive, Tony? When he starts out, and what's the process do? Why doesn't it survive? And what specifically happens when you go through that process with yourself?
Well, when you go through that process with yourself, you find a lot of the truths that you held weren't exactly what they were taught to us to be. And I think that's exactly what the schooling system is then designed to do.
Because the process that you just described, is a process of eliminating contradictions and eliminating arbitrary when there's no evidence or facts to substantiate, et cetera. And so it's a process of identification of that which exists or has substantial a basis in reality.
Which requires a method of asking questions first and foremost. And that process or method, I like to think of it that way, is really that impetus, that first, you know, ignition, that spark you need to discover certain truths and to open up to certain questions that you yourself wouldn't have dared touch before. And I think that's really where, you know, he got started in understanding that, why is he doing this? You know, when he started asking the questions and understanding that the children are already equipped enough to learn, they have their own ability, and just having raw experience shows how much more effective that is, and this idea of the artificial extension of childhood forcing us through the schooling system is intentionally put there. And his willingness to open up to the history of the schooling system and what we'll go into more really, you know, shines through, I think, with his own, how much he had to go through his own inner dialectic and his own process of discovering truth.
Well, I think it's important that he shows, like, even at his age, that he's not entirely sure what he thinks until he thinks about these things, right, and considers other perspectives that haven't been directly presented to him, etc. So I think what he's demonstrating is that he's showing a lifelong habit that, you know, he's gotten, to use the idiom, he's gotten bitten before by not thinking, by just accepting what he's been told, because he realized that the people who have been informing him haven't been using a methodology to validate the contents of their mind, and therefore, thereby, they've been, you know, passing around erroneous information unwittingly, nationally, however you want to see it. Very interesting.
Now, another point that I think needs to be brought up is the idea of what he mentioned with Orwell and Walter Lippmann, and how they go about stealing language, going in there and redefining it, and then people then, of course, become confused. And I think that's a point that we might want to just bring up quickly, because I remember, Kevin, what was the first line of that book you mentioned earlier?
The first line in the book, it's Social Science for Teachers by Charles Martz, which, as people will find later on in the Gatto interview, it also has a foreword by Elwood P. Cubberley.
Oh, right.
And we'll wait to get to that point. But yeah, it is the very first line in the first chapter, Social Science for Teachers, Education is a Process of Adjustment.
And that adjustment, first and foremost, seems to be done by stealing language and redefining it. People then start becoming confused, and they can then implant habits in people. And that's really the key to extending childhood.
When it's an adjustment administered by adults onto children without their full information, like informed consent, and nor are their parents being informed or, you know, giving consent to these processes.
Right, yeah, he called it, innocent self-delusion, because we don't even realize it. And a lot of the people are spewing out these lies, don't know.
All right, let's go to Jan Irvin in California. Are you there, Jan?
I am. You know, two things that I wanted to bring up is, you know, one is that, and this is something that I had mentioned, I think, in the logic group before, is that the word school, like school of fish, is a herd. I also find interesting and ironic the word class, and class is an equivocation if just said by itself, because it can mean a social status, or it can mean your place in school. So you go to school with the herd, with your class, right? And, you know, whereas the elites are not going to the same types of classes with the herd or with the school. And also the dialectic that the internal dialectic that Gatto was talking about, this is exactly the same thing that Gino Denning has repeated with us, that once you get yourself really familiarized with the trivium and with this information, this is a natural process that begins to start happening within the brain, and this is something that is laid out by Plato and, you know, with the discussions with Socrates and with these other guys in the Republic and things like that. It's discussed by John of Salisbury in the Metalogicon, or that's the same technique that he's using as he's debating Cornificus, or, you know, but Cornificus is a real character, we can assume, but he's still using this internal dialogue to debate this person in all of the different positions. And then we also see it in Galileo's work as well, the same sort of internal dialectic. And this is, you know, all of the old masters had this ability because they had this type of education.
Well, it's like what Jonathan Swift does in Gulliver's Travels, is he's giving you an internal dialogue in the form of a book that then takes you through a process of learning, whereby what you've learned by the end of that process of question and answer is a much different, and it's a more improved and more reflective perspective of reality than what you had before you read that book, which is what makes, you know, the classics great tools to learn.
Oh, I was just going to jump in to say that one of the things that school does as well, just in a general sense, with this outcome-based education, is create a thing, a stasis where people don't necessarily care about the outcome. They can actually excel without learning. And so all that reinforces is for people to look at any subject on a very shallow surface level. And it's only with real deductive critical thinking or trivium-based critical thinking that you get deeper into a subject and you actually analyze it and look into it with any sense of depth, and i.e. quality. So to me, it's the difference between going just snorkeling or going scuba diving and seeing how much more that can exist. You know what I mean? Below the surface.
I would agree with that. It's all about taking the shallow view that they've given us and using these tools to see past the limitations that they've placed in front of us and to surmount those challenges. And I think that's the origin of mental health, is being having a method to meet and greet these different mental challenges that we're presented with. And if they deny us the tools, they're basically setting us on a path to all be medicated, because they want to treat the symptoms that they cause through the public school system. What are your thoughts, Lise?
Let's see. You guys covered most of my notes. One thing that Tony reminded me of, Gatto had mentioned at the end the interrelationship between the economy and the way that we train the young. And earlier he said something about management not knowing how to effectively manage the classes. And it reminded me of the purpose of public compulsory schooling and the Prussian system, which we'll get into later. But I had been reading Lippmann's book, Public Opinion, earlier today on page 113 under the section covering newspapers and the information that we receive from them. This is reading from page 113 of Public Opinion. At its best, the press is a servant and guardian of institutions. At its worst, it is a means by which a few exploit social disorganization to their own ends. He goes on to say, for the troubles of the press, like the troubles of representative government, be it territorial or functional, like the troubles of industry, be it capitalist, cooperative, or communist, go back to a common source, to the failure of self-governing people to transcend their casual experience and their prejudice by inventing, creating, and organizing a machinery of knowledge. It is because they are compelled to act without a reliable picture of the world that governments, schools, newspapers, and churches make such small headway against the more obvious failings of democracy, against violent prejudice, apathy, preference for the curious trivial as against the dull important, and the hunger for sideshows and three-legged calves. This is the primary defect of popular government, a defect inherent in its traditions, and all its other defects can, I believe, be traced to this one. So what he's saying is that in terms of inventing, creating, organizing a machinery of, that's learning, that's education, that's learning taking place. And he's talking about, in terms of the omnicompetent citizen, I mean, he's talking about the self-reliance factor.
How could you be a self-governing person without the education that gives you a working model of how the world actually works in cause and effect, objective reality? And he's saying because the education system has taken that away, the entire nation is now turned into stimulus response on remote control of the marketers, advertisers, and corporate and foundational manipulators, the puppeteers of reality. And that's what Lippmann's entire book is about ever since 1928.
And that's interesting. And who is Walter Lippmann? If you refer to Tragedy and Hope, pages 939, 950, and 952, he describes Lippmann as the new recruit who has, from 1914 to present, been the authentic spokesman in American journalism for the establishments on both sides of the Atlantic in international affairs.
Lippmann is definitely an infamous character, and if you check the notes for this podcast, you can find the Wikipedia entry for Walter Lippmann. That is not the end of your journey. That is the first step in your journey, and it's your job to familiarize yourself with the various characters that you're going to meet along this journey. That is the ultimate history lesson. And Lippmann is least among them, but he's very important because his work and Edward Bernays' work plays a foundational role in everything that is the root cause of the corruption in education. I have a couple notes on the first 15 minutes. First off, we were talking about the shield of the Trinity. So there was a graphic up on screen to which I was asking John, what do you think about this? And it's not shown on camera, and it's kind of even more ambiguous through the audio. So I just wanted to clarify that. If you look in the notes, there's a Wikipedia entry for Shield of the Trinity. And the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost Trinity is a metaphor that's meant to conceal and hold secret a useful piece of information, which is the natural three-step process by which every human mind intakes input, processes information, and outputs communication or action or decision. So we then talked about metaphor, and is a metaphor a lie? Well, that goes back to Joseph Campbell. There's an infamous little story that he tells, that he was on a news show or in a broadcast, and the host didn't understand what a myth was. He thought a myth was a lie. I think I should just cut that in so you can hear what I'm talking about.
Throughout his career as teacher and writer, Campbell has been challenged by a persistent misunderstanding over the very meaning of the word myth, a misunderstanding he confronted most recently in a radio interview.
The red light goes on, and he starts out with this popular idea. He says, myth is a lie. A myth is a lie, isn't it? I said, no. You must talk about a mythology, a whole mythology by which people live, because that was out the window already. It's a lie. It's a metaphor. It's a lie. About 5 minutes to go, I realize this young man does not know what a metaphor is. So I felt that I could be tough too. You know, I have him now in a hammerlock, you might say, and he's not going to get out. No, I'm telling you, myths are metaphors. Give me an example of a metaphor. You give me an example, he says. I taught school for 38 years. I said, no, I'm asking the question this time. Give me an example of a metaphor. Well, the poor man fell apart. I mean, I felt ashamed. You don't do anything like this to people. Nietzsche has a saying, I think it's Zarathustra or the Will to Power one, the pale criminal, the one who has the courage of the knife but not of the blood. And I had no courage to face what I had done to this young man on his show, live to his public. The show was in his name. So he fell apart, and he said, I know what to do. Wait a minute, then he says, finally, and we now have about a minute and a half or 2 minutes to go, comes up from the floor, does, I'll try. This so-and-so runs very fast. People say he runs like a deer. I said, that's not the metaphor. Tick, tick, tick goes the clock. The metaphor is, so-and-so is a deer. That's a lie, he said. That's a metaphor, I said, at the end of the show. And that got into me. It is so simple to believe in God. God is a metaphor for a mystery that absolutely transcends all human categories of thought. Even the categories of being and non-being, those are categories of thought. I mean, it's as simple as that. So it depends on how much you want to think about it. Whether it's doing you any good. Whether it is putting you in touch with the mystery that's the ground of your own being. If it isn't, well, it's a lie. So half of the people in the world are religious people who think that their metaphors are facts. Those are what we call theists. The other half are people who know that the metaphors are not facts. And so they're lies. Those are the atheists.
And so the point is, the metaphor, if it's being used to open up your opportunities, to give you more options, and to teach you, the metaphor is a teaching tool. Now, if the metaphor is used to control your mind and close off your options and prevent you from discovering yourself, then that metaphor is a lie. So a metaphor is a tool like anything else. It can be used against you or it can be used in your favor, and it's your job to discern whether it's being used in your favor or not. Next, he talked about argument through abstraction, and I thought that was a fascinating reminder. And I thought it was at first I thought it was a non sequitur to my question. But then as I listened to him and as I reviewed the footage weeks afterwards, I discovered that, you know, he's a couple steps ahead of what my awareness was of the answers in real time. So as I've studied his words and tried to figure out what is he talking about, at the obvious point, he's talking about writing something out so that you have clear thoughts and then arguing with yourself to make sure that those thoughts are exhibiting aspects of objective reality and not representing something as arbitrary or unsubstantial. So I thought that's an important point, a tool that could be given out in public schools, but they don't find it necessary during their 15,000 hours to give us that tool. The metaphor of schooling, I thought, was fascinating, especially in light of Jan's additional Oxford English Dictionary referencing on that. It's the idea of taking individuals and making them all act and react alike. And when you get into hour five, when Gatto references Alexander Inglis's Principles of Secondary Education, you'll find that the six primary functions of schooling have nothing to do with education and have everything to do with adjusting your child or adjusting you, who've been through the school system, to fit in and be predictable and to react and think in certain ways that they couldn't otherwise get individuals who are unique to do. So I found that to be fascinating. When he said education to be diametrically opposite, right? I just thought that that's such a, you know, again, it's a poignant reminder that the purpose of education is for your survival, ultimately. It's your survival and thrival and satisfaction and serenity, all these things come as a function of education. Schooling is diametrically opposed, in direct conflict with needs for human survival, and therefore it's irrational. You guys all mentioned the stealing the key language and redefining it. That's Bernays and Lippmann, and we can find examples of that everywhere. Then there was the topic of the law of identity, which again is logic, which is the art of non-contradictory identification of that which exists in objective reality. So that's something that if it's the first time you've heard about logic or identity and the importance of the consistency of identity, the primary ratio, one-to-one, that a glass is a glass, if you define it to be something, it is that thing. We have words as labels on the things that we're perceiving, and that if you have contradictory, if you have two objects for one label or two, more than one label for one object, then you're going to get into arbitrary thinking, which doesn't reflect that which is. So that gets people into a lot of confusion. Another thing that could be cleared up through public schooling, but they don't want to give us those methods. And then he talks about the management of independent units and how the people who, the managerial class, can't figure out how to manage individual thinking people And therefore, they have to apply this 15,000-hour process of compulsory schooling to make us non-independent units. This is the idea of the nature of schooling, again, to make all the fish, you know, react and turn in the same direction at the same stimulus. And it's a stimulus response without thinking. It's the conducting of actions without understanding. And that, by definition, is psittacism. That should be in the notes. P-S-I-T-T-A-C-I-S-M. That means talking or doing, you know, talking about something, doing something that you have no understanding and yet you do it anyway. And so let's examine those actions. Let's question them. He talks about if we questioned any of these actions that we're taking as school or, as school teachers, nobody would be able to find answers. They would all be confused, and thus they wouldn't probably be executing a plan that's hurting children. But they don't ask those questions. That's the root cause. Asking questions got him kicked out. And then the independent livelihoods, early America being entrepreneurs, self-reliant. How did they have the ability to exist without public schooling? What high school did George Washington graduate from? What university did Thomas Jefferson graduate from? You know, there's a whole different paradigm that existed at the foundations of this country that there is no trace of these things left today. Now, when they founded this country, very few environmental problems. Today, total environmental like chaos. What's the common denominator? Well, you don't really find a lot of common denominators between then and now because the schooling system has changed so drastically that you know, that's the thing that connects the two, but it's not common to both because they had an education system back then that was allowing them to be self-reliant, self-sufficient, etc. And then that had to be taken away for America to be made incoherent. So the only other question I had was he used the word medulla. Did anyone catch that? I've tried to figure out what word he's saying and what the spelling is of it and what it means.
It's metal. M-E-T-T-L-E, metal.
Okay.
Because, and I did look it up, and let's see, the definition.
That's what I first thought it was when I was doing
the notes. The first definition that comes up is a person's ability to cope well with difficulties or to face a demanding situation in a spirited and resilient way.
Does everyone concur with that? Because I couldn't find any other word. It sounded, you know, I thought he meant metal, but it sounds in the audio like he said, I detest my own medulla. But maybe he was saying, I detest my own metal.
Metal.
Again.
Vigor and strength of spirit or temperament, staying quality, quality of temperament or disposition. I think that's
right. He had a gut check. He had to start asking questions.
I was put on my metal, is what he said.
Okay.
I was tested, in other words. My integrity was tested.
Now we're going to commence with the next 15 minutes of the first hour of the Ultimate History Lesson, and after that we'll return for the roundtable. Be right back.
Look around you. Three-quarters of our population has an independent livelihood, and the quarter who doesn't works to put a little stake together to set up on their own and write their own script in life. He said, as a consequence, we don't have proletariat as they do in Britain and Germany and the European nations, and we aren't able to have a factory system where it exists in this country, which is in New England, in the textile industries. A factory will have 30 or 40 employees. They'll usually be young women waiting marriage. They'll be served tea at their machines, and there'll be opera performances staged for just to keep them at the machine, because these independent livelihoods lead to, you know, totally private independent systems of value. So the British are wrong, but of course the Civil War changed that. We're sold that it was a great crusade against slavery by the school system. The major historians who've turned their attention to that say, I mean, to a person, that slavery was already dead. It was staggering through its last couple of generations, not because of a moral transformation on the part of plantation owners, but because the wives of the plantation owners were scratching their head and saying, you know, the boss, my husband vanishes for a couple of days. We have all these new slaves and they're not black anymore. They're various shades of brown. So they, I'm thinking right now, I think Vern Parrington, but a number of historians 50 years ago said slavery was on its last legs because the Southern womanhood wouldn't stand for it any longer. Russia, I believe, had freed the serfs. Britain and the continent had done this thing. We were going to do it too. But it gave a nobility to the necessity to get rid of the Southern politicians who were trained in dialectical thinking, in rhetoric, and could run circles around the Northern politicians in Congress. They could produce the most compelling arguments for this or that. And so the South had to be gotten rid of.
From my understanding, those dry goods like cotton from the South that were produced by slaves were then going to factories in the North. And the factory owners in the North figured out that the slave owners were paying too much overhead. It cost a lot to keep a whole family fed, et cetera. And there were letters exchanged, and they actually discovered it was cheaper. Why not make everyone a slave who doesn't know that they're a slave?
A wage slave.
Right.
And think only about the welfare idea. If you have a plantation family and you require harmony, even though some people are very subordinate, if somebody gets sick or too old to work, you can't, in fact, do the Simon Legree bit and get rid of them. Or what happens is morale collapses. So you have to care for them. The discussions on the highest level among Northern industrialists was, why should we have to support Deadwood here? And we could do that if they were wage slaves. Yeah, yeah. And furthermore, people like Count Tolstoy was well aware of the hard core underneath the Romantic arguments, and so were a number of other people. But the public dependent upon media and pulpits, which were subsidized by the owners, couldn't find a zone where they could think clearly, or someone would say, yeah, here's the truth. Think about it.
Early forms of mass media propaganda from the pulpit or the newspaper.
Or the Chautauquas. Sure, right. Oh, absolutely. The Chautauquas were put together by intent. The family that began Harper's Publishers and had the very prestigious journal of the time, Harper's Weekly.
Louis Lapham, the Lapham family.
Well, Lapham's a very latter day.
His grandfather was in charge of Harper's, though, and he was mayor of San Francisco, I believe.
Mayor, he was when the UN came in, and he told me that his boyhood was filled with foreign dignitaries in the home. His house guests were throwing back a glass of wine. So you can actually trace the small number of families behind the Chautauquas, which were the most compelling mass media of the day. And you'd hear about what was going on in Boston, out in Cincinnati, and you'd want that. And selectively, ideas and ways of thinking were introduced to the best people, and they used their local prestige to make sure that, you know, it's a natural process. So what we got was a second American Revolution between, 1865 and about 1910. This time the British won again, but they didn't win by force of arms, but by force of insight into the way opinion is created. And when the skilled workers who had intense pride and really were the key to the prosperity of early industrial operation, commercial operation, when the skilled workers understood their power, then industry and commerce were mechanized intensely, and you wiped out the need for skill. You took less quality, but now you had less contention, less argument. Carnegie was instrumental in eliminating the influence of skilled labor, and it continued right through the 20th century.
What influence have the Rockefellers had on organized labor, skilled labor, education?
The Rockefeller family can actually be traced way back in Dutch history. There's an ancestor of the Rockefellers who set up a rather detailed plan for global government. Hundreds and hundreds of years ago, it had just one of these flow charts that showed how you were going to do that or not. But the great irony, of course, is that Rockefeller and Carnegie's families were fringe people in the United States, but using their brilliant insight into leverage and how it works, both were able to take nothing and pyramid it into quite a bit. Rockefeller actually, his father, I believe, but it may have been his grandfather, fled a rape charge, sort of like Strauss Kahn's, up in Bainbridge, New York. He had been charged with rape of a maid and fled. They threw Rockefeller threw their weight behind, this is emblematic of how they were, behind Horatio Alger, who also had been charged with rape up here in Connecticut, and the Newsboys Lodging House. And if you read a wonderful book that exists, a limited edition, but it's kept continuously in print, called The Rise of the Dangerous Classes in New York City by the creator of American Adoption. When I started to research school, I kept running into the same people who put the adoption institution together and the school institute, one much more important than the other, but still the same names float in and out of one another. Charles Loring Brace, who I believe his father was the publisher of the Hartford Courant, I'm almost sure, in his early diaries say, "I must find a way to become nationally famous." I mean, in Yale he wrote that he didn't have any idea how he's going to do that, but finally, it occurred to him that with these masses of immigrants being brought in to break the Irish labor monopoly in the mines and the mills, that the easiest way to lower the unit cost of labor was to bring the husband and the wife into the labor force. You double the size of the labor force, you cut the unit value of the labor in half. But you couldn't do that as long as they were worried about their kids. So now you have the impetus to enlarge the social work industry, to corrupt the legislatures, to give it the power to break families apart. And what do you do with the kids? Well, the expression "put up for adoption" tells you, you don't want them anywhere in the neighborhood. You want them far away. So you put them in boxcars. This great secret, monstrous event in American history that goes on for 40, 50 years. Boxcars full of the children of the labor sent west. They started upstate New York. That was too close. So they kept going farther and farther west. And then they'd stop at a whistle stop. And a platform would be brought out. The boxcar would open. The children would be put up for adoption. They had a preference for who they wanted to adopt. They wanted Lutherans to adopt because they had the Episcopal idea of hierarchy, but they were just dumb farmers. They couldn't think clearly. Here was free labor. Hey, and that will end the future career of these immigrants. What stopped putting children up for adoption was the police chiefs of the West. I think the year was 1888, but give me a few years either way. They wrote a stinging attack on this practice, not on moral grounds, but they said crime is everywhere in the West. And if you go to the psychological abstracts, you'll find that an enormous number of adopted children, for example, 6 of the 10 leading mass murderers in American history, but all forms of crime, because when you break the bond with the natural, you can't put substitutes in place. Again, not morally. There's a recent physiological theory called mirror neurons, that you learn to use your own biological equipment by watching people who have the same or nearly identical biological. When you remove that, even if the family that you're transferred to has money and savoir faire and civil, they're more civil, doesn't matter. You're actually imitating things that your physiology can't accommodate. As a consequence, you get incrementally more and more crazed inside and angry. One of the things, of course, school does is it prevents these kind of connections between different areas from occurring. That's what the short answer test is about. And Oxford and Cambridge got rid of it 100 years ago, because they said people who do well on short answer tests, they memorize bits of information, but they don't connect the bits of information. And when they seem to be able to connect the bits of information, it's because they've memorized someone else's connections. The better the school, the more sets of connections you memorize. But you can't do that for yourself. You know, it's like these machines. You guys are all too young to remember. They used to sell machines that would relieve the stress of lifting weights. You'd put the weight in your hand, but the machine would lift your arm in the way. Only trouble was your muscle knew the difference. But the people buying the machinery didn't. Well, it looks exactly the same. Anyway, I put me back on course here.
Welcome back to Peace Revolution, episode 41. That was the second 15 minutes from the first hour of the Ultimate History Lesson, wherein John referred to topics such as slavery and the Civil War, and how we got into that. The phenomenon of the Chautauqua Movement, which was a series of tents that put up in town and come by and travel from town to town, and they'd have a big ruckus in town, and everyone else was working on the farm, and this was a novelty. So everybody was attracted to it. It was a popular form of mass media back in the day that had much more input and stimulus than your average newspaper. And since there was no radio or television back then, you're talking about something that has left the imagination of most people today. But if you can picture what it would be like to live in a very static town where one, you know, 6 days of the week, you can't tell one day from the other. The seventh day you go to church, have a picnic, and then you go back to work on your farm.
the type of excitement that could roll into town when a bunch of, you know, it's a gypsy-like caravan that comes in and sets up their tents, and there's all these charismatic speakers using this rhetoric that's highly advanced and coming out of urban popular centers on the East Coast and being proliferated by some people who own magazine and publishing empires, etc. So he really lays some interesting groundwork there. And so let's go to Tony in Pennsylvania there and see if we can flesh some of this out to make it more understandable and like connect it to practical reality. How does this affect people today?
Well, he just went over so much, it's kind of hard to where to begin, but I think he kind of started out more or less talking about the Civil War, and it's he definitely offers a different perspective than obviously what's taught in school, and that many of the major historians of that time had were commenting that the fact that slavery was already on its last few generations out, and what was really going on is that the factory owners of the North found out that slaves down south was too much overhead, and they'd much prefer to have their own workers, which I think ties back to the idea of individual units, people as individual units in a system, and also how do you manage individual units, and how that ties into the idea of the economy as well. Because it seems like with the industrialization process, that's really where it's all about. It goes, they tie everything back to a dollar value or an amount on a human's life.
Well, what types of needs do those new industrial corporations have that are being met through the changes going on around the Civil War?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that? Sorry.
Insofar as his comments to the Southern politicians having advanced forms of logic and rhetoric, and that the Eastern politicians, the Northern politicians, right, didn't have this sophisticated way to communicate and get their points across and to persuade audiences, and thereby, because they had this intellectual threat, because their schooling was much more, practically based on reality.
Yes, exactly.
And we use words to communicate our needs and get things done.
And to create public opinion. What creates public opinion?
Right. So the
and
persuasive
what's still taught
nature
at the elite boarding schools today is rhetoric, dialectic and rhetoric, but with a heavy emphasis on rhetoric. So that hasn't even ended. It's still it's been weaned out only to the or really preserved only for the elite schools and the elite, you know, the private boarding schools. So it's a very interesting point because they need to get rid of that, which shows that they need to start conditioning people through mass media, which he then goes into the Chautauquas and starts talking about that a bit, as well as he goes into talking about Rockefeller and the type of characters they were, both Rockefeller and Carnegie being both fringe people, which is interesting to think about. But what they understood and what was so important is they understood leverage. And that's just understanding how to use your power to your advantage and make sure that you can use different positions, people,
public
businesses.
Public relations.
Well, they discovered that you don't have to own a company outright. You can just have enough controlling interest or controlling influence on its board of directors, and you can steer that whole corporation. And that they figured out a much more efficient way to use their resources to control others, insofar as instead of controlling one or two or 20 companies in entirety, they could control thousands of companies by having, you know, these different measures or methods of leverage.
Well, you know, just to reiterate that point you just mentioned there, Rich, also at the times, also during that time, we have to consider that when mass media was getting started, that was also about the same time when you had Galton and you had psychometrics being developed, and they were starting to understand how to condition people more or less. And that's a really important point because we can tie that all, and later he will show how that all ties in perfectly together through that type of philosophy that they were holding at that time to show how they can pretty much condition people to be in, you know, units and work within the system that they need, which is really a mass production system. And so it's interesting that they found a way to lower the unit cost, he mentions, was by breaking up the family and getting women into the workforce. And I think that's a really, really important point because Rockefeller obviously later on threw their money behind the women's rights movement as a function to break apart the family. And that's something that's been going on for a very long time. And what they found out, I mean, this also worked to their benefit because then what happened was the children get left to the state to be educated. And that's essentially the perfect situation for them to implant ideas and really instill habits very early on. And all of us, really, to make sure that childhood is artificially extended. And so it all ties together so perfectly to their system. Not only does it make it cheaper for them to produce more and make more money, but at the same time it tears apart the family so they then can implant and instill their own values and habits they want.
Well, and they're teaching you what corporations need you to know to be interchangeable human resources, to be parts in their organization, to come in and do some tasks, but they could throw you away at any time and put another one in there. So it's not about teaching you what you need to know to survive in reality or to be self-reliant. It's totally to make you dependent on these people who are going to offer you the job after you get one of these, you know, degrees or pieces of paper after you jump through hoops.
Right, and that's the idea of the welfare state. They created so many various areas of dependency, and so once we buy into it, there's no. It's very hard to kind of claw your way out. Another point. Sorry, I have a lot of points here. Was something about the short answer tests and the fact that a child's brain, especially we've been going over the trivium for, you know, now you guys have been studying this for 2 years or at least a year now. And what's interesting is that what we've discovered, obviously, is that a child's brain, especially when they're very young, they're able just to pretty much pick up everything, but they don't have that dialectic yet developed. And it's interesting that it's just the short answer test literally probably in some way does affect the brain insofar as it creates, like he says, instead of learning about the inner dialectic, and again, it goes back to that own dialectical reasoning and logic, you instead memorize other people's logic.
Well, basically what it's doing is it's fragmenting your mind and making you incoherent because you're memorizing a bunch of things that you don't understand yet. And now that you understand that a child's mind is like a sponge and they're picking up everything, at that age, during that time of maturity, until they reach the point where they can question things and have a method to defend themselves, it is imperative that the parents or whoever's around them is only like surrounding them with information that's reflective of reality. And if you let corporate advertising or corporate films and media in front of your kids, their heads are going to get filled with a bunch of things that aren't reflective of reality. And you have to ask yourself the question, how does that benefit my child? How does that benefit me? You know, there's all these things that are going on. But knowing that your kids could be picking up languages and doing all sorts of far out things that aren't going to be put on your TV stations, you have to make time in your schedule to find out what could my child be learning at this age, surround them with those types of tools and resources, take them off of corporate TV, but it also takes a little bit of planning on the parents' part to be able to set that time aside to research what they could be learning and what they should be learning for that developmental level. But these are all, you know, steps that public schooling definitely doesn't give us, and we have to figure it out on our own, kind of trial and error. And that's
in a way, that's what Tragedy and Hope's all about, because we're trying to amalgamate these resources into a coherent understanding for people to be able to pick it up more easily and somehow utilize it to their advantage.
Who wants to go next? Let's go to Kevin in Virginia. What do you think, Kev?
Yeah, I think you guys highlighted a lot of the really good points here, but the power of media and pulpits and how that illustrates the power of rhetoric. I do think it's important to always put this power, this persuasive power of words and oration, in context with the historical time frame that he's discussing. How did people get the news at that time frame? What were their motives? What were the motives of the people with the power to even reach these large groups of people with such limited technology, and the leverage that they are able to apply to push these forces of insight, as he described? And that power of rhetoric acclimates people to constantly changing environments, essentially hijacking one's own ability to connect with history.
Well, and if they prevent you from knowing history, they're really preventing you from knowing yourself. And it's just another layer that they use to deny you knowledge of yourself.
Absolutely.
Did you have any comments on the family that runs Harper's and the Chautauquas, the Rainey, William Rainey Harper?
I just think that overall theme that he's bringing up with the early forces of fantasy, as Ernest Borman puts it, just kind of shows how these different communication styles can be used to, control society. And I think the Chautauquas are certainly indicative of that. As we'll get into later, the power of leverage with the foundations upon the General Education Board, and the J.P. Morgan interest in media, et cetera. So,
what about Horatio Alger or Charles Loring Brace, Kev? What can you tell me about those characters?
There's more research to be done for me on Horatio Alger, but the example that he's bringing up there shows how, you know, with Horatio Alger being charged with, I believe it was crimes with minor children, and how they were using his situation to run cover for the Rockefeller who is being charged with rape. And he's able to kind of, evade some of these charges by, you know, instilling the notion of giving back and creating this public front for misdeeds that can be covered essentially with bribery and leverage.
Yeah, because Horatio Alger was a very wealthy man of his day, and it just seems, if I can employ the idiom, birds of a feather flock together. And that's what Gatto is asking you to notice, is that not only did the people who set up your education and adoption systems and these things, not only were they like robber barons who have completely different needs in their minds than the average person for whom they're trying to act as custodian over, but these guys, there's another twist that happens when you have so much money and wealth that no one ever says no to you because somebody always wants your money. Think about the mentality that develops whenever you want, no matter how crazy, someone's going to say yes because they want money, and they'll do it for money, right? And so there's that whole other aspect that goes out there. What were your thoughts on this, Paul?
Let's see. Well, I can't help but have this recurring imagery from the movie Ben-Hur with those giant ships, which represent corporations, their corporate ships, and how they need all these guys to be rowing in time to the drumbeat, right? And that you'd have to be, you know, conditioned to accept those kind of circumstances. But what would be even more brilliant would be to keep those rowers in like a happy state, to keep them entertained. Maybe there's a guitar player with the drums, and make the conditions so that it doesn't even feel like slavery. We just kind of row every day and we get fed and it's cool. You know what I mean? And I don't know any life outside of this, but essentially they're getting the slaves who are rowing to pay for their own slavery, right? That's what we have to be conditioned to do, and we'll be willing to pay for our own slavery if we're conditioned to appreciate being kept. You know what I mean? And so that's this, again, the function, I guess, of the state and incorporating, breaking the independent spirit, you know, as Gatto talked about slavery being on its way out, because even Southern womanhood was asserting itself over the fact that they suddenly, these new, slightly lighter skinned slaves would suddenly appear, and they were, you know, it was just becoming an unpopular, unmanageable thing. And I thought it was really interesting when he was talking about, in terms of global development, the leveraging by these different families, and he actually said the words pyramiding it, which I hadn't heard that term used a lot, but that describes the hierarchical power structure, right? Where you've got one or a few people controlling the many through the omission of information or the misuse of information to control them. And, if someone's aware of that structure and is willing to create it, and they're a group of rapists, you know what I mean? Then you have to question the kind of moral and ethical standards that they're applying to, you know, trying to build these empires. Because I think everyone wants to leave a historical, indelible mark on history, but these people want to do it at any expense, and that's where the problem comes in. It's one thing if they're naturally rising above and they're so great, and it's an even playing field where everyone has the same opportunity. But when they're breaking our legs at the beginning through schooling and then telling us to run a race with them and then calling it a fair race, it's a giant hypocrisy. I thought that it's interesting that, with the mass media, the fact that throughout the ages, this art of persuasive speech has been somewhat perfected, right? And now it's become about managing perceptions with money. Right? It's not so much about the quality of what you're saying, but how many times you can afford to repeat what you're saying, right? And conditioning the public to tune in to the receptors of these messages at peak hours, right? Prime time or Super Bowl. And then you start to see all these events that are distractions are basically held so that all of the public's focus can be put towards certain ideas, right? And then, of course, that's reflected in how much money they charge for someone to put a message in during that time slot. And yeah, the thing with having all this disjointed soundbite style thinking and having no connections being made between all these things, people can see reality as all these independent things, but they don't have the depth to go and connect all the dots. And when you connect the dots, you start to see things that are pretty obvious. You know what I mean? Like when you're looking at a page full of dots, you just see a page full of dots. But if you actually draw and connect the lines, you're like, hey, there's an elephant right on this page. That's pretty interesting. But you have to see it beyond just dots, right? The grammar is these are dots, but the logic would be to connect them, and then the rhetoric would be to show someone the piece of paper with the elephant on it. And yeah, finally, I thought it was interesting how he mentioned that, you know, the co-opting of these different movements, essentially like the women's movement, so that they could double the labor force, get the kids into the schools, and eventually tax the whole population, which they only had. So they've profited in a myriad of ways, not just from the consumer end, but they've got these different apparatuses in layers that are constantly taking different kinds of energy and time from different kinds of people in different ways, but all the time.
Wage slaves, right? And at the same time, the corporations made more money because the cost of labor drops. There's more supply for the demand, right? They just put all these extra people in the workforce. And at the same time, hey, now these kids have a lot more time to spend focused on something that the parents wouldn't take time to teach them because it's not necessary for survival.
You just brought up wage slaves a minute ago, and I wanted to mention the book that Kevin, I think it was Kevin, brought to our attention recently, The Babylonian Woe by David Astle. Is that
I think correct? It was Nick Ulbrich that found the book originally, and then we all started researching it, and now we've all ordered a copy of it as we're listening and reading it. For the benefit of the audience, there's a link in the notes to a PDF so you can read it for free. There's a video on YouTube where you can listen to someone read the book to you. He does a great job of it. But the gist of the book is that the first central banks were set up in Babylon, that the system that is the Federal Reserve has been on this planet and has worked through different societies over the past several, 5,000 years. And it'll fund one society and then turn corrupt and greedy, and then it'll go to its enemy society, fund it, so it destroys its footprint. And that's how they've been able to propagate this pattern through history without, before now, really being detected.
Right, and so the idea of an indentured servant or a wage slave is a very old.
Right, because they were printing fiat currency back then. They had turned stamps and seals on paper into currency representative of gold and precious metals and food on store. And so all the same things today. They were making loans. They were charging interest. It's ironic how little has changed. And these are artifacts that come from the excavation of Ur, U-R. It's not University of Reason. I'm talking about the first city that they've excavated. That's where they tell us our history started, right? But when you excavate that city and you look at the artifacts, it shows you that what we have today existed back then. So that's by far not the beginning of civilization. That's just as far back in the story as they publicly will let us learn. And through public schools, right? Because I was taught about Ur when I was in public school. So I was like, oh, cool, that's the first city. Then from there, language must have developed and all these other things. No, it was all pre-existent at that time. The same system that we have today has existed for thousands of years. But the hope is, the opportunity that we have presented with this information is we are able to identify this cancer on this planet real time and to be able to understand its root cause, how it works, all the moving parts, and to be able to remove ourselves from empowering it to propagate further into the future, because now we have the chance, the first time in history, where we can proliferate this information among many, many, many hundreds, thousands, millions of people. I have a couple notes on the second 15 minutes. He touched on slavery and civil war. There's this whole idea of the philosophy of freedom that was a consequence of the Renaissance, which is a consequence of the Crusade, which is a consequence of these Knights Templar bringing this information back, sharing it with the Venetian bankers, Venetians trying to overthrow the Vatican. There's a lot of interesting history in there. Out of the Renaissance, having access to all this new information makes people understand that the system of feudalism and that the Vatican giving people power as kings, etc., isn't exactly fair. They start to come up with this philosophy of freedom. You have this among Martin Luther and the Protestant Reformation. Then the Vatican has a counter-reformation, but the point is, all throughout Europe, all throughout Russia, freedom of serfs and slaves was already happening. Emancipation was happening all around the world. So that's part of Gatto's point is it was inevitable in America for a couple of reasons. First, because Britain had already freed their slaves, Russia had freed their slaves, et cetera, et cetera. But also because of this interesting hypocrisy that started to raise its head in visual form of breaking down the barriers between slaves and owners of slaves, because these men were having sex with their slaves, and that was now part of the family. How can you treat them as a full slave? And this is the same issues that Thomas Jefferson had with his family, with Sally Hemings and whatnot. And there's a movie that depicts it. James Earl Jones plays like the grandson of Thomas Jefferson, and then they do a flashback to show what it was like. But the question and answer was basically around the subject of, did you have special privileges? Were you treated like the rest of the slaves? No, he did have special privileges. He was taught these certain things. They were spared hard labor. They were taught how to be self-reliant and think for themselves, et cetera, right? Because he wanted them to be free. Because by that time, it had become unfashionable for people like Jefferson to have such high morals and philosophies of freedom and yet still incarcerate people against their will and to take their lives away from them. So I like the part where Gatto says, you know, he observes that all throughout these centuries, there's no one who just says, like, here's the truth. Think about it. Like, all too few instances, which is why I think we need to do more of that. The second American Revolution, I think this is hugely important, the force of insight over opinion, public opinion. This is what Lippmann and Bernays, and that's what it's all about, because we're all influenced through words. The people who run this world use words to control other people. And so Carnegie and Rockefeller, you know, while they may have had a detailed plan for world government for hundreds of years, they didn't yet have the moving parts to deliver it. That's why they created the public school system. That's why they created the teachers' pensions and retirements. That's why they created the General Education Board. And it was headed up by Rockefeller, who gave $100 million to it, and also Frederick T. Gates, who was Rockefeller's partner. He was in charge of the General Education Board. So that whole thing, when you investigate how public schools begin and how teachers are paid and how they're guaranteed their jobs, it's all coming from these robber baron corporate foundational entities that have completely their needs are in complete direct conflict with human needs of survival. So that's oxymoronic and irrational. Then there was the whole point of Horatio Alger and the fact that these guys are all social deviants and predators to some notion, degree through their thoughts and actions. But then when he got into the adoption in schools, I didn't really get this before, but it makes total sense now that we've got the source material and we've been going through this. I didn't understand about adoption. I had a much more naive idea about what adoption was. But when I researched it, there were these things called orphan trains, and these trains went on for, you know, many, many years. They took 200,000 kids from the East Coast and would just ship them out west, and they'd pull up at the whistle stop. So picture yourself in your little house in a prairie town out west, and you're working hard every day on the farm, and you guys go to town to get some gingham, and up comes a train, and the guy comes out, and he's like, hey, we're selling kids, and you can buy one of these kids. And then you won't have to work so hard. And it's really cheap. It's like, you know, because they got lots of them and they're just selling them. So you can get yourself a couple slaves and then bring them up in your family. And you don't have to give them the same rights as your family has, et cetera, et cetera. So there was this awful, atrocious policy that everyone just kind of let go on. And it escaped my schooling. No one taught me about that. And then the short answer test. That's the formula for producing incoherent adults. And if you take a bunch of individuals who are unique, you make them all the same, and, oh, by the way, you make them incoherent, then that body that has been through that public schooling system then grows up into an adult population who are now voting, who are incoherent, and therefore cannot recognize their own incompetence. So the competence test is you take your beliefs, the things that you believe but haven't tested, and you take them out and test them. And that's what Gatto is talking about when he says you're arguing with yourself to try to refine that, and it never survives, because most every belief, a belief is a piece of knowledge that you haven't looked at yet. You haven't understood it yet. So you believe it. You're trusting it. He's saying that everything that he has trusted, that he's been told, that he went out and tested, he then had to make a new, unique version that was not given to him in schools.
Which is why a book like Tragedy and Hope is so important. And Quigley's work, because it is giving you at least another perspective of history to work with.
Well, and the irony is that Quigley's intentions for the book are not our purpose with the book. His intentions was to provide an accurate history for the aristocratic elite managerial class, for it to be used as, you know, to train CIA station chiefs and et cetera, et cetera. Our purpose, our value that we see in it is that he has taken upon himself to give us all these facts, all these actual archives from the Council on Foreign Relations and the true manipulators of our reality, the managerial class. He has had access to their archives. He was invited in, and he just puts it, he lays it all out. He did not intend it for people 60 years later to be talking about it online in study groups and to be really going through and figuring out the history of the world in our time. This is the irony, of his work.
And it's why Cleon Skousen says, as I see it, the great contribution which Dr. Carol Quigley unintentionally made by writing Tragedy and Hope was to help the ordinary American realize the utter contempt which the network leaders have for ordinary peoples. Human beings are treated en masse as helpless puppets on an international chessboard where giants of economic and political power subject them to wars, revolution, civil strife, confiscation, subversion, indoctrination, manipulation, and outright deception as it suits their fancy and their concocted schemes for world domination. I read that earlier today and I thought, oh, how
apropos to this situation.
How apropos.
Anyway, put me back on course here.
Is there any connection between frustration and aggression? And what effect does schooling have on that?
Well, you answer your own question by asking it. I mean, the connection's intimate. School removes your volition in all important ways. Even who you speak to are not the arts of association as valuable or more valuable than anything else you learn when you're young. I read how executive hiring is done, and it almost never has to do with your training in whatever you're being hired for. I'm thinking of Apple now, I believe. Is this the person we would like to have around 3 years from now? Have bend an elbow with, or play golf with, or just talk with. I mean, and that's why you're passed from set of executives to set of executives, so they can sign off, yeah, he's okay, you know, we can. But we don't tell kids that, right? It's people who have the highest grade point average and the highest SAT scores. Well, I spent an hour years, well, not too long ago, within 10 years, with the admissions officer for Harvard College, and about 30 years ago, an hour with the admissions director at Princeton. And let me tell you, their polite dismissal of grades and SAT scores was intimidating to listen to, as if you'd have to be crazy to let somebody in. Let me see if I can condense how you get into Harvard or Princeton. Of course, you get into both by donating a building, but how do other people get in? They're being analyzed on the basis of their ability to either become wealthy or famous. Either one will work. Famous, like wearing a billboard saying, I went to Princeton. There's that actress Jodie Foster, I went to Princeton. Look at where the rest of the actors and directors went. They didn't go anywhere, but Jodie did. So that's one we hear about. It's the Harvard lady said, we look for a record of excellence. And what does excellence consist of? It's sometime in the first 18 years of your life, figuring out how to add value to the people around you. Although she didn't say this, in a way that catches public attention. So you might walk across the United States or bicycle the perimeter of the country or row across the Atlantic Ocean. Those are physical ways. You might start a little charity or set up some weather service or some pollution monitoring around Hartford. There are a substantial number, a small fraction, but a substantial number of kids doing this as we sit here. They're writing a record of being able to add value to the community around them. And then the other fellow, the Princeton guy, said the same thing in different words. I asked him, what, this about 68 roughly, I asked him, what part of a resume submitted do you look at first? And when the answer, metaphorically, caused my jaw to open. Hobbies, he said. I said, I've been taught all my life, leave that off because it's not germane. He said, on the contrary, it's the only honest information you're likely to get. How does someone spend their time when it's their free choice to spend? He said, it's a window into their mind and their heart. What kind of hobbies? He said, well, ideally someone would have a physical hobby, an intellectual hobby, and a social hobby, because that would show they're exploring these large, well, physical hobby. You mean football, baseball? Well, he said, it's better than nothing, but we would prefer not to see teams. As I've been told all my life, the team sports identify your ability to work in a team. He said, what happens in a team sport is if you decide to dog it, it's very hard to tell which guy on the line has dogged it or not, or which running back has gone down quicker than he should have gone down there. He said, we prefer solo hobbies that involve physical danger. You mean you want kids to put their necks at risk? For example, what? I said. He said, well, horseback riding is a dead giveaway. The horse weighs a half a ton or more. If you do trail riding, you don't know what you're doing. Your head gets caught on a branch and you're the headless horseman. If the horse doesn't like you, it'll roll over on top of you. And I know immediately, because that last time I rode a horse was down in Veracruz, Mexico. The horse didn't like me. Took me out on the main highway with crazed Mexican drivers going 100 miles an hour and 18-wheelers. And it laid down on top of me. I was terrified because I could see these trucks coming. Didn't like that last time I rode. So he said, you have to actually know what you're doing. You can't say, is this an A job or a B job if you live and are intact with it. Then he said, sailing a small boat, these little 12-footers outside of land, if you don't know what you're doing, you end up in the middle of the Atlantic, or if wind comes up, you can't see landmarks because of the waves. I said, but those things are associated with the prosperous classes. What could somebody in ordinary circumstances do? He said, well, we just let somebody in. This is probably one of the nicest factoids in my mind, in my life. We just let someone in who invented his own sport and kept records competing against himself, his past performance, his present performance. It was, get ready for this, visualize this, seatless unicycle riding over broken terrain. If I had 10 lifetimes, the thought of doing that wouldn't occur. Started getting on a unicycle, let alone one without a seat, let alone riding it over broken terrain. So they let him in because they knew he was on the fast track. So we tell these lies, and of course many of the people who tell the lies believe the lies. Well, surely they're going to take valedictorians. Well, last year, Harvard turned down 8 out of every 10 valedictorians who applied, and the 2 they took in, they didn't take in because they were valedictorians there. So by removing this component from the student imagination, you can control to some extent who even applies to Harvard and then who gets in, who applies, because they don't know what they're doing. What's the IT garbage in, garbage out? So what I would do was I would examine. I have a friend who started a tutoring service called the Princeton Review, and 20 years ago, they were charging $300 an hour. I have no idea what they charge now. But what they did was crack the code of the questions on standardized tests. And Adam Robinson was his name. Adam took his money and left the Princeton Review to his partner. But Adam has written a book well worth, I think, your group looking up, called What Smart Students Know, Random House, What Smart Students Know. Adam was certain that you could pass standardized tests without having any knowledge of the subject, as long as you understood the constraints, the test, the question architects were under. For example, two of the four answers offered are always so absurd that if you know that, now you're left with a 50-50 guess. I had figured out when I was in high school that if you had some way to measure the angles on the little geometric figures on the test, that you didn't need to know. You could arrive at the answer simply by, simplistic means. The evidence that all of us know, standardized tests don't measure what they claim to measure, is that nobody you encounter on the upper reaches of society would dream of hiring somebody on the basis of those tests or in grade point averages. You'd be playing Russian roulette because they measure nothing. The grades largely measure that you memorize what you're told to memorize. I mean, there are a few other things, but that's the heart of it. So now you know you have somebody obedient, and probably for a clerk, that is a good measure. Not for someone who has to adapt to changing circumstances, by the natural selection process of reality. It's fairly easy without being a wise guy or very learned, as long as you retain the ability to think independently from the data in front of you, to penetrate the masks, the contentions that don't conform to everyday reality. So no one will hire you as a CEO and ask you what you're saying. But if you examine the data that's available about big-time politicians, now we have, and I don't think it surprised anybody, that George Bush, the most recent one, was a C average in high school, prep school, and a C average at Yale. What does surprise people is that the candidate he ran against was a C average in prep school and a C average at Yale and a lower C average than George Bush's, and the Kerry of Massachusetts. The fact that the best evidence that the nation has been schooled to the point of extinction is that they were fraternity brothers at Yale in a fraternity. I'll skip its interesting reputation. It only has 15 members. And they were fraternity brothers at Yale. There's 308 million of us. I mean, mathematically, I wouldn't know how to set the odds, but they would be stupendous. No one mentioned it, or if they did, it was to quickly get over that. That should have been headlines on the New York Times and the Washington Post. fraternity brothers at Yale run for president. You wouldn't need to mention that it was the Skull and Bones fraternity. So when the skew from sanity is that of that magnitude, you should not expect much to come from the watchdogs of our liberty and our best interests. How could that happen unless, what there's a Jewish expression, chutzpah, unless this feeling of contempt for ordinary people was very dramatic. I'm sure someone in the council who allowed that to happen said, maybe someone will notice. To dismiss that shows you how powerless. To believe, for example, another example, that the recent banking crisis, you know, the real estate bubble, is an oddity in American banking. There have been five such since 1961, savings and loan, technology, bubble. There have been five of those, and the central figure in all five is the Citibank of New York. Now, sometimes it's called First National. That's back in 61. Then it becomes Citibank. Then it merges with another huge and it becomes Citigroup. But the mentality loose on that level shows utter contempt for the safeguards built into, you know, the founding documents, or built into tradition as ordinary people, and that includes upper middle class ordinary people, expect it to be. It doesn't exist.
Welcome back. You're listening to Peace Revolution, episode 41. That was minutes 30 through 45 of the first hour of the Ultimate History Lesson with John Taylor Gatto. And quite a bit was covered in that 15 minutes as well. I've got a list of notes here. Maybe we should...
Well, we can start with the illusion that I was under the impression in high school that a record of excellence was whomever had the highest GPA, who was the valedictorian, whoever had the highest test scores. I was crushed when I scored low, very low, on the SATs, et cetera. And to put it in the perspective of, to hear Gatto say that a record of excellence is how you add value to the people around you, to your family, to your community, to yourself, to your own life. And what is value? I mean, is that improving the quality of your life? Is that improving the quality and the circumstances of your family's life, of your community, you know, et cetera? And so it's interesting that in high school, I perceived that a record of excellence had to do with my test scores. And it took me a long time to figure out that that isn't a measure of success in life.
It's a proof of conditioning.
Exactly.
Condition, responses, reactions, habits, etc. So whether it's frustration and aggression, volition, corporate hiring, school admissions, removing the component from understanding how these processes work.
Well, what is volition? Volition is your free will. It's your choice. And the question is, are you choosing for yourself? Are you making informed decisions? And are you acting in a constructive manner on your own behalf regularly, etc.? Are you improving your circumstances? Do you have more opportunities opening up to you or less opportunities opening up to you in life, et cetera? These are the things that measure, you know, how much you've learned.
Well, and that goes back to my first question to him. Is there a relationship, a functional relationship between frustration and aggression? Because if you move from confusion, fear, frustration into aggression, you have bypassed your opportunity for freedom. You have bypassed your opportunity to think and to reassert your free will. You have thereby bypassed your whole input on the system. You've turned yourself over to whoever is sending you that stimulus. And that's how they control all of us, and that's a major point. But it's also
a book put out by Yale, the Institute of Human Relations, the Frustration and Aggression Studies by
John Dollard, Yale University Press, 1939.
That is it.
D-O-L-L-A-R-D, Dollard.
Right, so that should be in the episode notes as well. But who wants to go first and comment on their perspective of what you learned in that 15 minutes?
Okay, I thought it was, like Lisa mentioned, the removal of volition, people's free will, kind of turns them into passive passengers in life who are just constantly taking dictates and following them through. So you're giving away your personal power to whoever is a decider, and that has huge ramifications in every aspect of your life, because it basically completely removes your ability not just to critically think, but to generally think just on a basic level. And you end up resigning yourself to watching a lot of TV and just sitting permanently in that passive mode. And then you wonder why there's rampant health problems. And like I said, it kind of trickles on down into every aspect of people's lives. The mention of cronyism and this kind of facade of people's accomplishments and credentials actually mattering when there's this, you know, whether it's nepotism or the idea of secret societies or fraternities happening in the background, it essentially is like a cheat. It's like we're going to have this thing where, you know, a bunch of us will be secretly in on something and to the exclusion of everyone else, and they use it for advantage or, again, leverage over other people. I thought it was interesting how he points out about looking on resumes, looking at people's hobbies to gain an insight into their minds as to how they spend their time, reinforcing this idea that currency is the real form of time, and that the goal, other than getting our money, the real thing that this whole structure of education and elitism does is to suck up our time, right? Whether you're waiting to pay a bill or correct something that's a false statement or something that you resent, it's a waste of your time, and you don't get that back. And when it comes to value, you're trying to apply, you know, how much is my time worth? And a lot of times we don't negotiate that a good value for our time, and so we end up squandering it. And that's the feeling of squandering your time, I think, is kind of like being on a seatless unicycle in rough terrain. You know what I mean? You're going to get penetrated in a way that's uncomfortable if you're not feeling in control that way. And then what else? Yeah, the fact that our memories are sort of conditioned to give these short attention spans, these very small loops, it allows them to repeat the same scams over and over, and for us to fall for the same kinds of scams, whether it's a housing bubble or a depression, recession, or, you know, falling for a false flag attack or a new war, you know, without people having the ability to critically analyze the past and see these patterns in history and then say, let's look for future patterns so that they don't happen to us. Instead, a lot of times the same style of scams is either repeated outright or modified slightly. And then the idea of chutzpah, or someone having balls, or the contempt for ordinary people, is essentially the rationalization for the to give them the mandate to abuse others, right? If you look at them as less than someone that's beneath you, then you're not going to have as much moral qualms to take advantage or abuse them, right? And whether that's a necessary function of rationalization psychologically so that these people can do it and not be complete psychopaths, or whether that's an actual mark of psychopathy or sociopathy, I'm not sure. And then the final thing I thought was really great that John mentioned was the skull and bones, the fraternity, the fact that this idea of secrecy is so feared that you can have two men who are both part of the same small fraternity at one university, both end up being the two guys running for president against each other, and it's mentioned by one guy who dies 2 years after he mentions it on the air, you know what I mean? And everyone else is like, I'm not talking about that, when it's I think it's a very relevant and prescient issue.
And if you'd like to know more, Anthony Sutton, is it Professor Anthony Sutton?
Yeah, he has a PhD. He has a Prussian PhD, so you call him doctor, but I don't think he called himself doctor. He's just Anthony Sutton.
his book from, I think it was published in 1986, America's Secret Establishment, An Introduction to the Order of Skull and Bones, which has within it a chapter, but it's also its own book that was put out, How the Order Controls Education.
Well, that's where Gatto's drawing some of his conclusions there, because what he's saying is you have these two guys who are from the same elite, aristocratic, managerial fraternity at Yale that came from Prussia in 1832 and embedded itself within an institution of learning here in America as a secret society, and that this small group has wielded power over time. And in the footnotes, if you're watching the DVD version of it, you'll see the references to the Anthony Sutton books, specifically America's Secret Establishment, An Introduction to Skull and Bones. I believe it's Chapter 8, which is called How the Order Controls Education. That book was a standalone pamphlet, and what Sutton did was, after he had like 20 of these pamphlets, he put them all together into a book, and it goes through. And so How the Order Controls Education points specifically to Yale and the Prussian connection to Wundt and the PhD system and all the things that we'll be talking about for the next, five episodes. So what you have is someone who's pointing some of these things out, and you can start to see it clearly, but only once you go and walk to these different mountaintops of, literary perspective and look and see how they saw it. And then you have like a comprehensive perspective because you've encircled this entire area, if I can employ that metaphor.
And then just to mention one other book lastly, because John mentions the banking crisis and the bubbles, et cetera, and a reference on that would be William K. Black's 2005 book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One.
Tony, Kevin, do you guys have some thoughts on the 15 minutes that we've just listened to?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what both Lisa and Paul both said, really highlights the dichotomy of a world where you have adding value versus credentialism. He describes how the standardized testing functions as a tool for drawing out the desired responses and the memorization. But where that credentialism comes in is it creates a whole new status within society that is divergent of history, that creates this Mandarin class and an expert class, or this is where we get the professionals in quotes, and the creation of a self-perpetuating ruling class or elite that gets to, they basically defer the happiness of the people to a state system that only thrives on progress and arbitrary progress at that. So, and it just furthers this idea of a logocracy, or where words or intellectuals using words are the ruling power, and they use this as a way to constantly manipulate the social reality, essentially stealing from us a unique and realistic version of reality.
As opposed to that which we're given in public schools. So.
Right, as opposed to a laboratory experiential model.
So to employ another metaphor, the map that they give us in public schooling of reality is not reflective of reality, and actually and literally leads us into pitfalls that are very profitable for those who have set up their establishments. It's like a game of Monopoly, only they started the game and they already own all the properties, and we're just like finding our way through the board, getting charged taxes. We don't even understand what's going on, right? And so there's a lot going on there. What do you think, Tony?
Well, I was going to ask Kevin, was that from the Power in the Highest Degree?
The Power in the Highest Degree is does have some of the references, as well as...
at least the one word, logocracy.
Yes, so power and progress. Yeah, that's absolutely where I picked up that word. And what kind of dovetails on that is that, Woodrow Wilson was a student PhD at Johns Hopkins University, and he had a quote that was, we want one class of persons to have a liberal education, and we want another class of persons, a very much larger class of necessity in every society, to forego the privilege of a liberal education and fit themselves to perform specific manual tasks. And I think that is just totally indicative of what Gatto is saying here. And on a larger level, with him, attending Johns Hopkins University, which was set up as a seminary of pedagogy, based directly on the German state theory and the pedagogical institutes going back into the late 1700s.
That's very well said. It's interesting because now, like Otto mentions later on, it's now run its course. This is now the end result of having this installed for well over a century. So at this point...
Well, because at a certain point, the incoherence that they've manifested for their profits, and it comes to... make an incoherent society where there's no more resources left to steal. Like, the con men have already made, like, they've gotten all they can get out of this place, and now the pattern through history is they will move to another market, probably the Asian and emerging markets in India and et cetera, and pull the same scam on those people. And now, over 5,000 years, it basically has gone full circle, consuming and organizing all the resources of the world without anyone during that time really coherently figuring this out, creating a piece of media, informing their neighbors in such a way that it can be passed on through time and not forgotten. And so I think that we are breaking some unique ground here, because with the internet, with electronic file copying and you know, the way that things work, if you create something useful that is providing value to people, they will pass it around among each other, and that's why we put this out for free, because these are supposed to be the useful tools which they have occulted or hidden or kept secret from us, and that's how they make us all confused, fearful, incoherent, et cetera, et cetera. But there is a methodology by which you can transform that fear, confusion, unknowing situation that we all find ourselves in, and find high degrees of certainty through a replicatable process that you can use hundreds of times a day if you're a thinking person, considering your actions and not just doing things on reaction of stimulus response.
That allows us to step outside of the feedback loop, I was just going to add. And it's just interesting, you know, researching quite a bit into cybernetics and general state theory and systems theory, and understanding, you know, the lineage of where some of these individuals came from.
That all just means those are all methods and engineering and scientific applications of how to control human resources. They think absolutely. That they're chosen and they can control us. And if they know us better than we know ourselves, if Yale Institute of Human Relations has studied the human mind and knows your reflexes and knows your conditioning better than you do, guess what? The people trained by them are going to be in control of your actions until you go through the work to liberate yourself by asking questions and making substantial answers valid, you know, in objective reality and checking it.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think there's one common denominator in a way here is that they not only remove, like he mentions, that school removes volition and even who you speak to and associate yourself with, but then he says the thing that's lost, I believe he says this, is the art of association. And it seems to be everything goes back to association, which then can go back to logic. You can, you know, go back as far as saying, insofar as like people, for example, when he mentions the standardized testing and what all the standardized testing really do is they measure what you're told to memorize. And we go back and refer that to how essentially how they're artificially extending childhood, how they're also conditioning people in school, and how that goes on and on and on. Well, what they're really removing here is the arts of association in all forms. And really, because being conditioned just to memorize is being conditioned to do a certain compartmentalized job, and then therefore anyone's will can be implanted over you, or the life story can then be told about you. And so it's very simple to then not having a way to manage the thoughts and have an understanding of what's going on, having a process to go through it like logic, you essentially are
what is
a
this mystical response. What is this mystical process logic? Isn't that just the method by which one identifies and attaches words to objects in our environment without contradiction? That's basically all it is. You look around your house, look around where you are right now listening. You see a bunch of objects, they all have names that you attach to it. Each and everything has a word, and that is the general grammar or the basics of our reality. That's how we can understand it and think about it in our minds, and it's how we communicate with each other. So logic, even though it's a strange word, because it's not taught to us in public schools, right?
It's making explicit what we implicitly do.
Right, and what they hide is that association, because and they force us to get in that kind of preliminary mode where you're just always memorizing, and what you don't realize then is you're really just
you're within a... Well, that's what artificially extended childhood is. It's not being response-able. It's not being able to respond to your changing environment, irregardless of your level of certainty, et cetera, because you have a methodology to attain higher degrees of certainty, to dispel fear, confusion, et cetera. It's being self-reliant.
Well, it's understanding.
And so that's what they've removed, your ability to be self-reliant, and then to help the people around you also become self-reliant in your community, et cetera, as an extension of that which you've
learned. It's about identifying what exists, understanding your needs of survival, and then making your actions and decisions according to your needs of survival. And how
right.
they cloud or obscure that whole thing is to introduce all this other stuff that they make you think you need to be accepted in school socially, and all these other areas.
Materialistic things.
Right. Conspicuous consumption and all these ideas. Thorsten Veblen would be the author you'd want to reference on that, conspicuous consumption, and how materialism was brought into society to cloud our needs, and it's no longer about form and function, not only in marketing or advertising, but in people's purchasing. And people started purchasing things to make themselves cool and to be hip and all these other things that Bernays and Lippmann and these advanced public opinion makers.
Well, and it's because their self-confidence has been removed. And when you don't, when you are insecure and you are not self-confident because you're not self-reliant, etc., then you're always trying to fill a void artificially.
And they can, you know, what's interesting on purpose.
What's interesting is, like, then he mentions that the students that do get into these, you know, Yale or Princeton or Harvard, these Ivy League institutions, what they actually look at, and the only truthful information that's usually presented to them is their hobbies. And it's not just about, and he mentions three, physical, intellectual, and social they usually look for, but team sports are no good. They want something that's a bit dangerous and also, you know, something you do yourself, and it's also creative and different. And, you know, it's just interesting because we did all these different ideas of self-reliance, creativity, you know, standing out amongst others, you know, leadership.
Well, that's just a sign that the managerial class doesn't want sheep, and they want to create managers. And so they need people who are individuals who know how to go off and get things done on their own, to be able to navigate through uncertainty and to do all these things, to go past fear. This is the things used to keep the status quo and the sheeple to sheeple. They want, for the managerial class, that's the propaedeutic function as defined by Inglis and secondary principles of education. That's one of the functions, is to create a new managerial class to keep culling the herd and to keep grooming us like they're some sort of, you know, ranchers.
And really, isn't that sort of like, people talk about the new world order, but the old world order and the new world order are just different methods by which the managerial class manages the masses.
They're tactics, because it's a group of managers who use a tactic as the new world order, which is to control you through words. Old world order was to control you through sticks and chains and cages and swords and these sort of things.
And the new world order wants you to love your servitude.
Right.
Well, we shouldn't forget that the old world order as well used religion, which is still being used in its many forms, whether it's the occult or the new age or Catholicism, Protestantism, Judaism, at all. They're all different forms of mind control and controlling the masses. So now they're just developing a capitalist style of management rather than the old world order style of priesthoods.
That's exactly right. And what they've done is they've studied the human being. They've made these connections of how to condition us, just like they condition pigeons or squirrels or any other animal by making us short on our needs, and then they use that as a reward, whether it's nuts for the squirrels or money for the people. They make you short on money, and then you'll do crazy things for money. They connect the frustration and aggression to take away your volition. That takes away your freedom of choice. When you get frustrated and get aggressive, you stop thinking. You literally... it's the amygdala in your brain cuts off. It's a fight or flight reflex that is now being used against people, right? So you have to physically, like, push that apart, that stimulus and response, and insert your thinking. Use this methodology. And then they basically go through, he's telling you the corporation hiring, how you get a job is not really how you get a job. They've given everyone an incorrect map. It's not reflective of reality. What about school admissions to get into college? Oh, all the students have been given an inaccurate map that leads them to nowhere. And the real back, you know, here's the back door. Here's the secret way to get in. If you do any of these things, you can drop out of high school now and go get into one of those colleges, because they'll let you in if you do these requirements, right? And so what we have are adults that are telling us lies. The teachers, the parents, they believe these lies only because they've never questioned them for themselves. So it doesn't make them bad people. They're all helpless. We've all been undermined. And the reason they undermine all of us, because individually, we each have a talent. We each have a unique potential that could be very easily realized. And they have to go through a great amount of trouble over many centuries, spending trillions of dollars to take away that chance that we have to live our lives and to express that individual potential, to develop it, to discover it. Maybe not in that order. You'd probably develop it after you discover it. But the point is that they go through a great deal of trouble to undermine each and every one of us, because we have equal capacity to learn to use our minds, our brains, our bodies, our hearts, our arms, and our legs to get things done that are not in the interest of the status quo, but are in the interest of human beings who want to thrive and survive without preying on each other, without taking away our volition in order to achieve some sort of profit. The definition of profit is any gain of satisfaction or happiness that is not gained at the cost of taking away someone else's rights. And once we all get on the same page as far as what we find profitable in life, I think less and less our actions will be tied to the bait of money. Because money is used generally to make people do things they would normally not be doing with their time, energy, or concern or focus, but because they need these things, and we've been, there are mandates and laws and rulings going on right now in this country that prevent people from being self-sufficient, from growing their own food, from milking their own cows and drinking it, right? So they are taking away all of our ways to be self-reliant, including schooling, all over the place, right? So the way that we put these things back is by starting to do that for ourselves, not depending on someone else to put us through a class to teach us these things, by realizing that the most valuable and profitable thing that we can be doing with our time and energy is to be learning our way out of this ranch and to create a way so that other people who want to escape this, it's like a slaughterhouse, right? They are taking, whether they're killing you quickly or killing you slowly, whether they're killing you like the shepherd or killing you like the wolf, they are consuming your energy, they are taking away your freedom of volition and your choice, and that is freedom, and that is liberty, and that is life. So, albeit they're not stabbing you directly in the back with a literal knife, figuratively, metaphorically, they are doing it. They're stealing your soul because they're stealing your time.
Well, and because they're taking away your access to the things that you need for survival. They're taking away your access to clean water and to healthy food and to all of the things that you need to be self-reliant, as you just said.
And they, they pretty much flaunt it now because they, Gatto mentions, school. What more proof do you need to show that America has been schooled to the point of extinction when two fraternity brothers are running for president? What are the statistical odds of that ever happening? And on top of it, it was a famous fraternity, of course, Skull and Bones.
Well, so, the only journalist who really mentioned it was Tim Russert, and he was soon dead suspiciously, not too long after he questioned that, right? So maybe he should have known better than to ask questions like that on TV.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, this Skull and Bone Society is a society that had individuals like Timothy Dwight and Andrew Dixon White and Daniel Coit Gilman, who were intimately involved in the manipulation of the education system at the behest of Carnegie, went and stayed with them at his castle, were intimately involved in setting up the foundational structures that allowed for the motives and agenda to be pushed through.
Well, that's the Yale Troika. They laid the groundwork for the PhD system in this country. So all these universities and administrators of schools who are PhD trained, that's a compartmentalized mind control system. It's not a comprehensive education of anything. And then when you look at the roots of what you've invested your time and money into, you'll see it's not an education, but you're there to actually put the lid on the jar and to contain the free will of these children instead of teaching them how to unoccult information into how to ask substantial questions, find valid answers, and use their curiosity as a map to learn about everything they need to survive.
Absolutely. And, and Andrew Dixon White, being intimately involved in starting Cornell University, also was a schoolmate of Edward Lasker, who was responsible for drawing out the plans to unify Germany around Prussia under von Bismarck. So some of the secrets of Skull and Bones, lay in plain sight in the importation of these ideologies.
Well, that is an astute observation. Does anyone else have any comments or questions before we move ahead? Right on. Did any of you guys see the guy who came out on, I believe it was BBC, and he said it was a trader from the financial markets, and he said that every night I pray for a recession, and how he basically makes all this money from people panicking and from the markets going bad. And then there was all this hubbub in the news that it was a hoax, et cetera, et cetera. But now there's been confirmation that he was a real trader, that the comments he was making, even though they're reflective of reality, they shouldn't be in doubt because now, they've verified his identity, et cetera. I thought it was interesting that people were able to dismiss the message because they said the messenger was fake, even if it was a yes man, somebody was pulling a spoof and getting on TV just to tell people the truth. Everything that trader said is reflective of the actual reality of the market. And I just found it so interesting that nobody could cover it, but they could all cover the question of who is saying this, and it's likely a hoax, et cetera, et cetera. Did any of you guys see that this week?
Well, I mean, I saw a news article right when it happened, and I didn't realize that they then tried to kind of throw this red herring and find, you know, redefine who he is and say that's not correct. I had first saw the article, and it's, you know, it was just about the essentially the whistleblowing, but not in the sense that he was blowing the whistle, but in the sense that he was out there explaining exactly how it was going down. And everything he mentioned was pretty much spot on to everything I think we come to know now with the markets and the fiat money system and how and speculation in markets and, you know, gold and all these different scams being played.
And with that, I'm going to play the quick clip of Alessio Rastani, who is a broker who now has been verified by The Guardian, a United Kingdom newspaper, to be indeed a trader. And so even though his facts are reflective of reality, you can now feel totally comfortable now that they've verified his identity, that you can take this information and use it as food for thought. After that, we'll be playing the last 15 minutes of the first hour of the Ultimate History Lesson, and we'll be right back.
It's going to crash, and it's going to fall pretty hard, because markets are ruled right now by fear. Investors and the big money, the smart money, I'm talking about the big funds, the hedge funds, the institutions, they don't buy this rescue plan. They know the market is toast. They know the stock market is finished. The euro, as far as they're concerned, they don't really care. They're moving their money away to safer assets, like treasury bonds, 30-year bonds, and the U.S. dollar. So it's not going to work.
We keep hearing that whatever the politicians are suggesting, and admittedly it's all been rather woolly so far, isn't right. Can you pin down exactly what would keep investors happy, make them feel more confident?
That's a tough one. Personally, it doesn't matter. I'm a trader. I don't really care about that kind of stuff. I go with what the... If I see an opportunity to make money, I go with that. So for most traders, it's not about we don't really care that much how they're going to fix the economy, how they're going to fix the whole situation. Our job is to make money from it. And personally, I've been dreaming of this moment for 3 years. I had a confession, which is I go to bed every night, I dream of another recession. I dream of another moment like this. Why? Because people don't seem to maybe remember, but the 30s depression, the Depression in the 30s wasn't just about a market crash. There were some people who were prepared to make money from that crash. And I think anybody can do that. It isn't just for some people in the elite. Anybody can actually make money. It's an opportunity. When the market crashes, when the euro and the big stock markets crash, if you know what to do, if you have the right plan to set up, you can make a lot of money from this. For example, hedging strategies is one. Then investing in bonds, treasury bonds, that sort of stuff.
If you could see the people around me, jaws have collectively dropped at what you've just said. I mean, we appreciate your candor. However, it doesn't help the rest of us, does it? Or the rest of the Eurozone.
I would say this to everybody who's watching this. This economic crisis is like a cancer. If you just wait and wait thinking this is going to go away, just like a cancer, it's going to grow, and it's going to be too late. What I would say to everybody is, get prepared. This is not a time right now to wishful thinking the government is going to sort things out. The governments don't rule the world. Goldman Sachs rules the world. Goldman Sachs does not care about this rescue package, neither does the big funds. So actually, what I would actually tell people, I want to help people. People can make money from this. It isn't just traders. What they need to do is learn about how to make money from a downward market. The first thing people should do is protect their assets, protect what they have. Because in less than 12 months, my prediction is the savings of millions of people is going to vanish. And this is just the beginning. So I would say be prepared and act now. The biggest risk people can take right now is not acting.
Alessio Rastani, thank you very much for talking to us.
Do you dream about the economy at night?
I try not to.
Yeah.
Nightmares.
18 minutes past 11. Ordinary people, and that includes upper middle class ordinary people, expect it to be. It doesn't exist. Now, what we've run into is a people infinitely more sophisticated than us, with a 5,000-year civilization, who are even more amoral than we are, and look at starving 3 million people to death as they did 20 years ago. Is there any shortage of people? I mean, they're already running circles. I've spoken in China half a dozen times for various groups, and the Chinese government is a little bit worried, not a lot, that their system of schooling, very like ours, except more disciplined, it seems to constrain the inventive imagination. The reason they're not worried is they don't recognize copyright law or patent law, so they have access to anything there. But they will not accept, they keep asking me back, they will not accept that the system they're applying to the young mind is guaranteed to foreclose the imagination that produces invention. So I'm happy to take their money and get a chance to see Xi'an and Shanghai and Beijing, but they will follow the course we follow. It'll just take a little bit longer, that's all. Your turn.
In China, they have the outcome-based education system, but they're seeking to tweak it so that they can kind of improve it. They said that we want to keep our people under control, but we want them to be more creative and productive and efficient and happy while they're doing it, right? Now, the question is, if America has become more incoherent, wouldn't that be a function of the Prussian education system, outcome-based education, being used to control the workers and make more profits, and now it's just run its course?
It's run its course. We're exhausted now. Our schooling is exhausted, and the national vitality's been exhausted. I'm glad you used the term incoherence. About 3 or 4 years ago, the Financial Times of London, on the editorial page, accused us of being you may have read the same piece I did, an incoherent society, that we had lost a reason to be a nation at all, because subsidizing bankers and drug companies wasn't a sufficient reason to proceed in history. Yeah, we're incoherent. We don't, nation comes from the root, family. And we no longer have a concern other than a rhetorical concern with one another. I mean, obviously there are many individual exceptions to that, but the government clearly has no such concern. We have evolved an economy that depends upon constant warfare. And even though it was stretching it in Iraq and Afghanistan, when those are over, we must have another conflict. We're going to have to stretch it even further. And maybe attack small islands, Fiji maybe, because they represent a menace. Being a child of World War II, the idea of calling something a war where the enemy has no army, navy, air force, intelligence service, where they blow up their feet in their underwear, it just stretches the bounds of the ridiculous to call it a war. But we got an object lesson from a television comedian who said, when you fly planes into a building, it certainly shows you have courage. And that was temporarily the end of his career. You do not speak in opposition to the main forced driving events. Yeah, yeah, no, to look at America between, let me roughly say, 1800 and 1865, and then from momentum right up to the First World War, there's this explosion of invention, and it comes from the unlikeliest places. It does not come from university-trained inventors. It comes from everywhere. It's the way people saw the world around them. They saw this, the elements, the raw material. They processed it a slightly different way, and then they had the expanse, the rhetorical capacity to say, hey, look, there's a better way to do this. It was happening so frequently that a crisis occurred in capitalism. And without understanding this crisis, you really can't understand why our schools are the product of the Rockefeller family, the Carnegie family, the Astor family, the Vanderbilt family, the great capitalist families. They understood that the real problem in successful capitalism is assembling capital, getting people to give you their savings on the promise that you'll give them more back. But if you have people in an inventive matrix who can look at the way the expensive business is doing things, open up across the street and either do it cheaper or better, or simply open up somewhere else where no one is doing it, capital is always at great risk. So, oddly enough, I don't want to claim credit for what really is a brilliant insight, but I want to crave credit. It was openly discussed, let me say, from 1880 to 1900. We were being forcibly converted from an economy of small farmers, small engineers, entrepreneurs, into a corporate economy. And these men doing it, they weren't intellectual dumbcoffs. They could see that as long as the American inventiveness was loose like a wild beast, they were going to have a lot of trouble pulling care. Someone would say, but I saw, you know, Jack, and he went belly up. So Prussian schooling, which had, for a different reason, had been out to destroy the imagination. And let me say to anyone listening to this, when someone makes a reckless statement like that, you make sure they can document it. And I will document it as long as you're willing to walk to your local public library. Because in every public library worth its salt in the United States and in every college library, you will find a collection of essays by a Prussian philosopher, Johann Fichte, who was the immediate heir to the University of Berlin's philosophy department, which had been under Immanuel Kant. Fichte wrote a series of, it was over a dozen public essays to the Prussian king from, let me say 1808 to about 1818. They're called Addresses to the German Nation. And the provocative event that set the first one off was the Prussian army, which was the Prussian economy, renting soldiers, stealing other people's stuff, had been whipped by Napoleon's amateur army at the Battle of Jena in 1806. And Fichte said it was because this demon imagination was loose among ordinary soldiers, and in situations they would override the orders from headquarters about what to do, and that's why we lost. Now, what should fascinated anyone listening is, that's exactly what the so-called liberal philosopher Spinoza in Holland had said in 1690 in a book called Tractatus Politico Religico-Politicus. Tractatus Religico-Politicus. Spinoza said that the ordinary population was so psychologically diseased, murderously so, there was no way to heal it. Just as Fichte, 125 years later, said there was no way to heal the disobedience gene in people who thought for themselves. Fichte said we have to set up a system of forced schooling, universal forced schooling, in which we destroy the imagination. Bells, ordered lessons, constant testing, rankings. Now, if it were only those two major figures, but you now can go back a few hundred years in history to John Calvin's Institutes of the Christian Religion, which is this thick, tiny print. But if you ever go mad and actually force yourself to read it, rather than to read what an encyclopedia tells you it says, you'll find that Calvin says that the saved are saved before they're born. The damned, who are 19 to 1, are damned before they're born, and no amount of good work or behavior can save the damned, and no amount of evil behavior can damn the saved. The expression that used to be pretty common, but has vanished, I think on purpose, is justified sinners. The saved are justified sinners who can do anything. They can carpet bomb civilian populations, whether they're Nazis or Americans. You know, you've done no harm, according to Calvin. Calvin said the only way the elect, he called the saved, the elect will be ever be safe because they're outnumbered so heavily, is to set up a system of universal compulsion schooling with the intention of destroying the imagination and filling the head with garbage. Spinoza said the same thing. Fichte said the same thing.
So I think we just ran out of tape. Is that what happened? Is that one still running?
Yes,
but it has no micro. Yeah. All right. So we're going to take a 10-minute break.
Oh, good.
We're going to change the tapes. I'm going to turn all these lights out. We're going to turn the AC back on and cool you off. If you want to get up and move around, use the bathroom.
Well, if I could just interject quickly, I think one of the most important statements that John makes, which I think is reflective of his style of teaching, is after he asserts that Prussian schooling is out to destroy the imagination. And he says, when someone makes a reckless statement like that, essentially substantiate it or make sure that they can substantiate it or substantiate it yourself. And what he's hoping to do is to provoke your independent learning, right? And so he makes a lot of statements that may seem, as he says, fanciful. But if you take the time to go and look yourself at the original...
Just like why he says he went back and read Calvin's work or something like that.
Well, because something provoked him into action.
He's like, don't read what it's in, you know, an encyclopedia. I went to the actual original source and read it.
Well, because the whole dynamic here is that almost everything he's saying is alien to most people who haven't studied these things, right?
Exactly.
And so since everything sounds so outlandish and he sounds so certain, that's what would stimulate me if I didn't know about this. I would go out and start looking this stuff up and start doing some research and going through the footnotes and the episode notes for this and watch the video and look at the footnotes and references and that and really start to get a handle on this because it's all right there. Gatto says at one point, it's all laying on top of the ground, but no one's going to point you to this stuff. The system is designed to make sure that there is no one in your path of influence and, you know, reaching you with this information, because those of us who can get it out there it's really just reaching the choir. It's reaching the early adopters, the people who already sense that something's wrong. And really what we have to do is be able to communicate with the congregation, to use that metaphor, even though this isn't anything religious, to be able to get the message across to people who don't know anything about this and might be listening to it for the first time and in complete disbelief. Because until I really took a critical look at my memory of schooling, I thought it was really great. I was one of those kids that was perfectly conditioned. I didn't get detention ever. I got straight A's. I excelled at all this stuff. I you know, did all the things that I was supposed to do, jumped through all those hoops, got my degrees. Never once had to show my degree to get a job, by the way. So that's how little connection that has to anything. It's all about what is your life experience? What can you do that's individual and unique? And for me, I had started my own business during college and taught myself some useful business skills that they don't teach you in any classes. So these things all come to the surface when you come into contact with this information, and you really have to think about, yes, I remember, like, you know, there's 4, 5, 6 great teachers in my life, but out of that 15,000 hours, there had to be hundreds of other teachers who really made no indelible positive mark that I used in everyday reality. You know what I'm saying? And so it brings up these questions. What is this system for? What does it do? What is its form and function? Who designed it? And why are we trusting our children and our most precious resources to it when we know ourselves, after a critical examination of the root causes of all these problems in the world? It all goes back to the corruption of our ability to recognize predators, to communicate amongst ourselves, and to take constructive action that relieves us of that predatory nature.
Well, I think that also shows Gata's wisdom insofar as the way he's able to take you along this story. I remember when we first finished this filming, we both thought, and I thought for sure, that we would have to kind of cut it up and splice it. But no, he actually told a very coherent story the whole way throughout. And I wasn't until, you know, going back and listening to it a couple of times and realized that it's actually, he knew exactly what he was doing and how to kind of build it up so people can get an understanding. And this really, I think, is one of the greatest mediums to present the people that would not be familiar with this type of information. And he just does such a great job at really helping you, like preparing a ramp, as the metaphor. Preparing that ramp so you can slowly start climbing up without too much difficulty.
And he makes a lot of statements that seem almost inflammatory, like we have evolved an economy that depends upon constant warfare. Right. And that's a big statement to wrap your head around. But if you do a little research, you find Major General Smedley Darlington Butler in 1935, who has ample experience, firsthand experience.
And was recognized
talking,
for that.
Speaking on the subject, yeah. His book, War is a Racket. Now, this has been around since 1935, and I didn't know about it until, I don't know, a few years ago, when I discovered it on my own, not as part of a curriculum in a school.
All right, so what I'm going to do is... Because you guys are all bashful. You guys are all so smart, so humble. All right, so what I'm going to do is I'll go through my notes, and you guys can just interrupt me and chime in. All right, so we jump in at like the 45-minute mark. He's referring to China, this 5,000-year-old civilization, and its presence on this earth. And we're really not well-informed as to the history of China. It's a completely different language. We can't pick up their primary sources and read it for ourselves in most cases, unless you're extremely talented. In this country, everyone prides themselves on knowing one language and making everyone else speak our language, right? Then he comes out with the idea of the Prussian schooling, this whole ideology that is there to destroy the imagination of children, that it's guaranteed to foreclose on inventiveness. Now, if I might just make an observation here, we have an economy which is evidently, substantial evidence exists to demonstrate that our economy is dependent on warfare, right? And we have problems, and problems are solved with invention, okay? Now, if our education system has been corrupted by the Prussian schooling model, this corrupts the inventive process, i.e. our ability to recognize and solve problems. And these guys like Rockefeller, Carnegie, Astor, Vanderbilt, these corporate robber barons, to use a word that's not inflammatory, these robber barons, created foundations, corporate foundations, to carry on their will and to carry on their plans long after their death. They have been contriving competition by controlling the markets and extinguishing small businesses. And you have a corporate economy that is based on the destruction of inventiveness, the destruction of imagination. And now we have all these problems stacking up in our society.
Right. They call it, what, the crisis of capitalism, I believe.
Right. So what could be the problem? We have all these problems stacking up. Why aren't we coming up with inventions to solve these things? Oh, because the information we're trying to use to solve it is a corrupt information set that doesn't reflect reality, and therefore any time we try to invent our way out of it, we get bitten. If I invent a new business model that's supposed to help financial corporations get software cheaper and to help those software companies get their sales cheaper, and then I find out that those companies, neither one wants to lower any of their costs because there's a bunch of money laundering going on, my business model then becomes obsolete in the light of reality. Do you see how that works?
Exactly. And it's a shift in power. Because if you come up with a free energy model, for example, it's an obvious shift in power. And no one
exactly.
is willing to give up their grip on the control panel
All right, so
of
that,
society.
So that's how I realize in 2003, after I make this naive business plan to help these companies and to lower their costs, right, that there's all this laundering going on and that no one's reporting on it, I then, you know, decide we need to be able to get media out there. That's the origin of Eighth Estate Media and the podcasts and Tragedy and Hope and everything that follows, right? So it's about taking observation of your environment, testing your theory of how you think you can help, and seeing if that's actually realistic. What I learned was I was naive. I had no idea that all these markets were being used to launder money and that everyone likes the high expense of all these things where they don't want to save money. They want to pay all these exorbitant fees because it helps them in some crazy, irrational way. So this irrationality that we just noted brings us back to Johann Fichte in Prussia, and his chief influence of philosophical views was this guy named Immanuel Kant, who was in charge of this university, who created what can be referenced now and hereever after as a philosophic corruption of reality. Because basically his philosophy and his spin on things removes cause and effect, removes objective reality, and now people can be convinced of any truth. And this was necessary because after Napoleon had defeated the Prussian army at the Battle of Jena in 1806, the Prussian government then said, how can we have a war economy if our army loses? And the answer came in the form of von Clausewitz's On War, where he made all these notes, which then transitioned into the Prussian education system, which then made perfect robot soldiers for the society. And the Prussian economy in the 1800s, the mid-1800s, after they integrate this, was then super powerful, super profitable, because they had implemented this education mandate upon all of their students to limit and kill off their curiosity and their inventiveness, right? However, Prussia is soon going to eat itself in about 60 years because of this process. This is how the Nazis come about. So it's then exported to Japan, to China, to the United States. And we've all now gone through this process, which is now coming to an end because the dumbing down has left us without the inventions, without the ability to recognize these predators, to take action that is constructive and actually brings about the results we're looking for. And this is the system of forced schooling taking its effect on America over the past 100+ years, controlled specifically by a group of people who consider themselves to be justified sinners, to be the quote-unquote elect, who can tell us that we have to go through universal compulsion schooling, that we have to have our imaginations destroyed, and that people like Spinoza and Calvin and Fichte and Kant and all these other people have put it as their mandate to designate the rest of us as irrational and hopeless, and instead of giving us these basic tools of learning and these methods of dispelling confusion, they have chosen to prey on us and our families century after century. And if you look further into this investigation, you'll find that the whole eugenics program was at the root of public schooling, is at the root of our culture of war, is at the root of this gangster class of materialistic managers who think that they can mandate what the rest of us get to do with this precious thing called...
So it's like a philosophy of death in some way.
They do.
In all institutions, in all functions of society.
You have a multi-generational cult of people who worship death, and they have created the major systems of our society, and they protect themselves through proxies they've created called government. And the people in those governments, the people in Congress and the people in the Senate, do not take into account any of our perspectives as individuals, therefore, by logical definition, cannot represent us in any way, shape, or form in our, you know, in their views. Since they're not talking to us, they're not gathering this information, they're taking action based on who's paying them to vote which way. And that is not a democracy. That is rule by people who have the most money and the most ruthless techniques to make people do things against their volition, which is diametrically opposed to everything that we're trying to teach people how to do for themselves. Which
well,
is
diametrically opposed to everything that we learned about what this country was founded upon and what freedom and liberty, et cetera, is.
And what's the common denominator here that they have to destroy? Victor called it what, you know, the demon imagination, right? It's the imagination or the, our creative function and our ability to, you know, take the raw materials and process them and, you know, come out with something new and then kind of reintegrate that new understanding. And that's really the process of learning comes naturally to people. So they really had to find a way to destroy that. And that's essentially what they did.
So it's not just the disobedience gene?
No, the disobedience gene, right? I mean, he lays out this beautiful story. Well, it's not just a story, but how did he put it? He said he saw the patterns, the pieces. He just, put them together or something like that. Because you have Spinoza, you have Calvin, and they all pretty much say the same thing, that we're all hopeless. The masses are a hopeless breed that needs to be controlled, and the only way to do that is by setting up a universal system before schooling. And he didn't mention yet, but that's also what Plato mentioned, right, in the Republic. So, I mean, he draws out this perfect line of philosophic thought that's been, common for the past 2,000 years at least, and, it shows how it kind of redevelops for certain eras in time. And but they're really saying the exact same thing, and that's the important idea he's trying to push forward here, is that same philosophy has been instituted into our main institution that they force, kids to attend when they're younger, which is, the public schooling system. And in doing so, no one understands the form and function, where it came from, the five W's plus how on the system. No one understands it at all. And so we had it, Gatto really elegantly in his books and his works and public speaking is elegantly laid out.
Or are you saying, are you asking, in order to be informed about the social institution called public schooling, you would have to answer the questions, who created it, how was it created, when did they create it,
exactly.
Why did they create it, when did they create it, these sort of things, how did it come together in these different layers, how did they get their funding, where did teachers' pensions come from? These are all things we've already mentioned, but these are the general basic questions of knowledge that need to be answered before you can claim to understand any system that you're participating in. And I don't see how kids or their parents are ever given full disclosure, and therefore it's a fraud.
A century fraud now. Well over a century. So, like you said, it's run its course. We're now seeing what essentially has happened. And, obviously we know what's happened in history from the Nazis and what happened in Russia and the Cold War and that whole fraud and everything that happened, and it is now, happening with us and our debt crisis. He mentions the bubbles. There's been five such bubbles, technology, savings and loans, and all these issues.
I thought it was interesting that to look at the dynamic of their plan can almost work too well, like it works against their own interests, by drumming out the creativity of everyone by making it so uniform that they leave populations in a state of creative depression or creative hunger, or just they no longer have the drive, the individuality to take as much large risks, right? It's like that's the phrase in, well, I don't know if it applies as much in Japan, but it's a Japanese phrase. They say that nail that stands tallest gets hit first, and so that's a way of reinforcing uniformed conformity. And China, several other countries in the Asia and Australasia area are like the sweatshop regions, right? Like that's the place where corporations go and set up economic free zones so they can have these lawless plots of land where they can have legal near slavery conditions, right? And it requires a certain mindset and set of social conditions in order to make that a possibility to run things that way, right? But as long as we're not aware of that, because we're not educated about the fact that, kids might make our shoes or that our food might be grown in these conditions, but that all these costs are being externalized and kind of spread out throughout. And, we're like, as long as we can go to a store or buy a thing, unwrap it, eat it, and the process is done, we'll accept that kind of shallow explanation of things. And That's I think what represents the status quo in general, right? Is just having a shallow understanding of things, and yeah, critical thinking employs the ability to deal with the roots, right? That's where the roots are. Is they're in the deep places. So
the questions that arise are: is there corruption in the public school system? And if so, was it intentional? Is this by accident or is it intentional? And then I guess the hours 2 through 5 will tell us how that was done. But let's discuss what we think about the first two questions. Is there corruption in the public school systems, in the very nature of its form and function? And if there is corruption to be found in there, if it's not serving our needs to be educated and to survive and thrive in this world, then what is the purpose and how is that all going on without anyone protesting it?
Well, and the evidence would be, are children coming out of high school and or college prepared to not just survive and get by in life, but to thrive?
Are they being given an accurate map so that when they get out in reality, they can survive and thrive? Anyone?
Based on that, I'd have to say no. I'd have to say they're very ill prepared for reality and for real life. And they're under the illusion that by attending college and attaining a degree, a certificate, et cetera, that they are somehow guaranteed a certain lifestyle and a certain...
Or that it improves their choices and opportunities at all. Because
exactly.
They're being indentured. They're going in debt to get these educations that aren't actually educating them. And then they're not getting the employment, the quality or quantity of compensation for employment to be able to compensate for the debt that they've created.
Well, and the jobs that they're going to be competing for are going away. They're being eliminated. They're being sent overseas, et cetera. And the available job, the jobs that are becoming more available are service-related jobs. And so are you really spending tens of thousands of dollars or hundreds of thousands of dollars to send your child to school to
provide
become
them with an outdated map.
A service
right.
worker? I mean, you could go into a service industry straight out of high school and just based on your work ethic, your ability to adapt and survive, et cetera.
Yeah, that's an example that the form and function is not indicative of what we need to thrive and survive in this world. So what were you going to say, Kev?
Yeah, I was just going to say that, I mean, it would seem that would really just limit the opportunities by that process of overspecification, that the outcome-based jobs only lead to perpetuating the same system. So essentially they have, you know, people in a position where they become themselves institutionalized in the problem because their livelihood depends on it. That's what I would add to that.
Does anyone else have any examples or commentary on whether or not the public school system is corrupted in its form and function? And if so, is that corruption intentional?
I was just going to comment that I think there's a lot of divide and conquer going on in that whole public education system, whether you've got the teachers against the parents, the students against the teachers, making the students go against their parents, the unions going against the student or the teachers, and the government who holds the purse strings. You know, there's all these different elements of who's responsible and who's to blame for this whole thing, right? And we can point the fingers at the root, I think, and understand that there's a group who set us up to fight against amongst each other, right? And so that's the first step. Take away that group's the power of their intention by coming together and uniting on identifying that, and then working towards logical applications of solutions where you can see, you know, even if it's we are purposely set up to fail, there are solutions. There's ways to reintegrate positive learning things into your education, your personal education.
Yeah, because we're finding out that we were set up to fail, and it's not too late. We're still alive. We still have our minds about us, and we can still take reasonable actions. And so Kevin, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was going to say that I think the answer is really both. I mean, I think the evidence is clear with this interview and with other research that we've done that there was a true intention to manipulate and cause these outcomes. But I think it also, you know, being both is based on that self-perpetuation where our livelihoods then become indentured to that purpose. You know, and if you look at we were talking about
making a series of choices that we didn't consciously inform ourselves about or decide on, and the summation of all these things that we've decided on without thinking then turn into a form of indentured servitude, because now we are held slave to these decisions that we didn't have volition, we didn't have input, mm-hmm. we wouldn't have made these choices if we had the choice, but our choice has been taken away, and that's been evidentiarily, it's intentional.
Yep, and they rescind our humanity to a point of entropy where value judgments are no longer necessary, and holding conflicting thoughts or dualistic thoughts on these ideas is no longer in conflict with the self-preserving feedback. And how Johann Fichte plays into this would be that his wife was introduced to him by Johann Pestalozzi's wife, and Johann Pestalozzi's methodology, not to mention that he was a member of the Bavarian Illuminati, his methodology of, as Gatto puts it, killing them with kindness, or as I would say through the research I've found, he was kind of he had access to a large group of children who were of the lower quote unquote classes, and he was tasked with the situation of trying to engineer a group of children that were not worried about moving up within a social strata. Therefore, you know, kind of, you know, it shows that
he experimented on homeless children.
Absolutely, yeah. And he had his own schooling where he, you know, Yverdon School, I believe, where he had people come from all over the world to study his methodology. And I've got documentation of Thomas Jefferson receiving one of his books, which could be provided in the episode notes. So Pestalozzi's influence within the United States is great for the methodology that was imported. But you can also, you know, St. Louis has streets named after Pestalozzi. Pestalozzi's ideas were a large centerpiece of the Hegelian movement.
Even though all of Pestalozzi's projects were failures, his methods and means of achieving failures were adopted globally.
Mm-hmm.
That's
ironic. Yeah.
If I might interject with a reading from a book published in 1953 by a chap named Bertrand Russell titled The Impact of Science on Society, in a chapter titled Scientific Technique in Oligarchy. This is pages 50 and 51 for those of you playing at home. Fichte laid it down that education should aim at destroying free will so that after pupils have left school, they shall be incapable throughout the rest of their lives of thinking or acting otherwise than as their schoolmasters would have wished. Reading on, diet, injections, and injunctions will combine from an early age to produce a sort of character and the sort of beliefs that the authorities consider desirable, and any criticism of the powers that be will become psychologically impossible. Reading on, as in Plato's Republic, be taken from their mothers and reared by professional nurses, gradually by selective breeding, the congenital differences between rulers and ruled will increase until they become an almost different species. Reading on, the laboring class would have such long hours of work and so little to eat that their desires would hardly extend beyond sleep and food, the upper class being deprived of the softer pleasures, both of the abolition of family and by the supreme duty of devotion to the state, would acquire the mentality of ascetics. They would not care for anything but power, and in pursuit of it would not shrink from cruelty. By the practice of cruelty, men would become hardened so that worse and worse tortured would be required to give the spectators a thrill. I firmly believe that if the Nazis had won the last war, and if in the end they had acquired world supremacy, turning to page 52, they would before long have established such a system as I have been suggesting. Now, to prevent these scientific horrors, this is reading on in the next paragraph, there must be also a kind of respect for the individual that inspired the doctrine of the rights of man. Right, and then he goes on and he talks about Hegel and totalitarianism and all sorts of other things. You got to get this book, got to read it. It's very interesting. Bertrand Russell, it says on the front, is one of the greatest philosophers of our modern age. He examines the changes brought about by science and suggests that its work in transforming society is only just beginning. He takes an optimistic view of the future and the prevention of war. Well, if you actually read it, he does no such thing. And what he's describing is a technocracy, the very same as Technocracy Incorporated, of which Zbigniew Brzezinski, the grand chessboard author and infamous connectee between Osama bin Laden and so many things, that guy is part of this. There's actually a movement that's gone on for 60 years to take what Fichte and Spinoza and Calvin and Darwin and Plato laid down and to propel it using technology to account for all of us and Facebook us and Google monitor us, systematize all of us, and to know everything about us and to know us better than ourselves, and that is exactly how they control us. And every time I bring up that Bertrand Russell quote, people want to throw, you know...
But you're taking it out of context. Well, it all depends. I mean, it's hard to understand his intentions unless you have a comprehensive perspective of him,
right.
Even then. But the point is that you can observe in your environment that is going on, what he described. It is possible now, and it's becoming a reality.
That Fichte wanted to do it, but he didn't have the technology to
do
it, and Bertrand Russell
That's
is bragging
important.
About how they now have the technology to carry out the plans of Plato and to create this upper class and to create this utopia where they take away the family and they control breeding and they control your education and they create a caste system, and this is the plan that they've put in paper. It's in writing. It's in all the top schools. They're all taught about this. It's 1,000, 2,000 years in the making. And we are here in the middle of it to realize it, to call it out, and to do something practical about it, which is to help other people understand what's going on before they try to take action. Because that's what I see on Occupy Wall Street, a bunch of people taking action without understanding the big picture. And that's the opposite of what we're trying to do. We're trying to understand, what are the origins of this? Well, if you see it goes back to Babylon, maybe you'll take a different strategy on how you're going to occupy Wall Street and change these bankers' minds. Maybe they need to be met by a superior philosophical force and not some mass of people who don't have any idea of the origins of which they're trying to battle. Just my thoughts.
Or the root cause of the problem that they're trying to solve.
Right. Any other comments, questions, conjunctions? Dangling participles.
I was just going to say this was a really productive first episode. And, you know, I think the next four are going to be really good. And it's great to hear all your guys' opinions and interpretations
Likewise.
Of everything John's saying. So I look forward to the next episode with you.
Yeah, thanks, guys. That was great. I really had a great time.
What I'd like to point out to them,
I think we'll only get better and better, just like the logic calls we do. So.
And we'll be putting together the notes and posting it with this episode. Also, any of the books that are mentioned during the interview with John, Kevin has gotten an archive together of the PDFs, and we're going to post them. And soon we're going to have the ultimatehistorylesson.com up, which is a site that will have the audio. It will have these Peace Revolutions episodes 41 through 45 to provide context. It will have the footnotes, references, transcripts, translations, anything and everything that can help you get the most out of this treasure trove of information. Featuring the legendary educator and author, John Taylor Gatto. And I'd like to thank those of you who helped me get this message across today for your time and patience and for being prepared. I think we did a really great job, and I'm proud of everybody who participated.
Thank you.
Peace.
Nice, guys.
Feel free to edit me where I stammer, and please do. Thank you. In fact, you could probably just read that Libman quote yourself. I couldn't get that out.
I think, look, you guys had minimal notice, minimal preparation, but it wasn't a super complex task. You see how it goes, and next week you'll know exactly what to expect because we're going to do the same thing again. But I won't have to say, Tony in Pennsylvania. The audience has already built out an idea that there are people internationally talking about this and being able to draw a lot of wisdom from his words. And that'll inspire them to step up to the plate and be able to do likewise, because it's not about us being the experts. I think it's about giving the audience the chance to develop their own potential and to see that they are every bit as capable of doing anything that we're doing right now as we are. And if they put some focus and attention into it, maybe we could start learning from them, and improve our game, because that's all we're interested in doing is figuring out how to get to the truth efficiently, effectively, consistently, using a method, and therefore being able to communicate cogently between each other. And, and that's how we really get progress done. The opposition, the aristocratic managerial class, like Lee Camp says, they're organized. Evil people have a plan. They got PowerPoint presentations. They got office
flow charts.
And part of what we've been doing over the past couple of weeks is saying, what makes our opposition so successful in dominating us? oh, they're much better organized. They have time management. They know how to get things done. And if we don't put these skills in front of ourselves and give everyone the same palette of tools to work from, then the managerial class will always be the managerial class. That's how they've stayed that way. They've kept the proliferation of tools, useful tools, away from the everyday person and told the everyday person and conditioned them to believe that they don't have a potential here, that they don't have a place here in the script of life on Earth, that their role is to be a slave, to be someone in the background. And we're here to tell you that you don't have to play that role, but you do have to study how to be yourself. You have to study how to know yourself, and you have to figure this out for yourself. All we can do is kind of point the way and provoke you into disbelieving anything that you're hearing so much that you go and look for yourself, and we're providing you with the links and the notes. So we're just basically daring you to click, and all you're going to do by clicking is improve yourself. So there's nothing to be afraid of. It's something that anyone can do. We're trying to build this bridge across, you know, this gap of knowledge that gives the managerial class their power. The information gap is the power gap, is the monetary gap, that's the wealth gap. They're all the same thing. They're based on these group of managers having tools that the average person doesn't have access to. And if we can use the internet to our advantage while we still have it, then it's to everyone's advantage. So go and do likewise. Thank you for tuning in and not dropping out.
Be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, well, you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are a changing. Drum writers and critics who prophesize with your your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin. And there's no telling who that it's naming. For the loser now will be later to win. For the times, they are a changer. Come senators, congressmen, heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway and don't block up the hall. For he who gets hurt will be he who is stalled. There's a battle outside and it's raging. It'll soon shake your windows and rattle your walls. For the time, they are a out the land. Don't criticize what you can't understand. Your sons and your daughters are beyond your command. And your old road is rapidly fading. Please get out of the new one if you can't lend your hand. For the times, they are a change. The line it is drawn, the curse it is cast. And the slow one now will later be fast. As the present now will soon be the past. And the order is rapidly fading. And the first one now will later be last. Please get out of the new one if you can't lend your hand. Better stop swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the loser now will be later to win. For the times, they are a changing.
Thanks a lot.